Terrific. I will call the meeting to order. Obviously, we do not have a quorum, but we do want to stay on schedule because we don't want to be here till midnight like the Health and Human Services Committee was night before last. And so Representative Ward is prompt and ready to go, and he said he's going to stay within his 12-minute time limit, so your multitude of testifiers can come forward and we'll see how this works. Representative Ward, we'll move your bill when we get a quorum, but please proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I am Representative Ward here to talk about House File 983, the Business Career Academy program, a three-year pilot that we want to have done up in Brainerd and then work out throughout the state. I just want to make just a brief comment, and I'm going to turn it over to the rest of the testifiers. And Madam Chair, we will stay within our 12-minute allotment. We appreciate that very much. We'll get an A+, and I know our support because of that. And Commissioner Segrin, Commissioner Al Segrin, and Governor Plenty have both seen this bill. We've met with them and are very much excited about this bill, and it goes right along with their incentives as well. So I want you to be aware of that, members, Madam Chair, right from the start. I will now turn it over, and I'll have my testifiers introduce themselves as they go through the testimony, Madam Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Ward. Welcome, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Pat Swarthout. I'm Central Lakes College marketing instructor. Also wearing another hat today as a member of the Brainerd Lakes Area Chambers of Commerce Workforce Committee. We're excited to be here today. Mm-hmm. The Bridges Career Academies and Workplace Connection initiative is a result of over 3 years of development with more than 40 presentations to a variety of constituent groups. Our proposal is a response as to how business and education have been impacted by societal changes in the Brainerd Lakes area and other parts of the state of Minnesota. We have a shrinking traditional workforce, 4 people retiring for each person entering the workforce, the need to connect business, parents, educators, and students to let them prepare for workforce needs. 20% of the jobs nationally require a 4-year degree. 80% do not. In a study of Minnesota's ninth graders in 2002, only 25 out of 100 students completed a post-secondary certificate, diploma, or degree. Today's workplace requirements are more than a high school diploma. Yet, 60.5% of the working population in the Brainerd Lakes area has a high school degree or less. Dr. Larry Lundblad, Central Lakes College President, will introduce the next portion of the proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Swarthout. Welcome, Dr. Lundblad.
Okay, thank you, Chair Grayling, committee members. We're very excited to be here this afternoon. I'll just briefly talk a few minutes about some of the uniquenesses of the initiative. As I started my presidency July 1st at Central Lakes, I was very excited to see this project well underway, and there was good discussion going on. I've been an educator for about 30 years. We've had a lot of discussions, but never any action. And this proposal, this initiative, has plenty of action, and it was very, very heartwarming for me to see that everyone was on the same page in terms of working with students and providing opportunities. The project includes Central Lakes College and 5 local school districts, Brainerd, Staples, Pillager, Pequot Lakes, and Crosby Ironton. In addition, we have business and industry partners and, of course, the Chamber of Commerce and the Workforce Committee. So a very solid group. The districts are found in 4 of the legislative districts, districts 4, 10, 11, and 12. And we cover the portions of the counties of Cass, Crow Wing, Morrison, and Todd. On the handout that you have, there's several things listed in terms of critical and unique components of the Bridges Initiative, and I'll just briefly comment on these items. First of all, the initiative is built around meeting the needs of business and industry and providing pathways for students. It also incorporates the SCAN skills, and if you remember, this came out of the Department of Labor back in 1991, identifying skills that workers need in the global economy. The Bridges Academy also, as I mentioned, is driven by business and industry, very involved in the development of this initiative. The academies have a requirement of work-based learning. And this is where the chamber will come in. The chamber will assist us in identifying sites where students will do internships or job shadowing. The Academy's initiative is based on regional workforce needs. We've utilized DEED, the data coming from DEED, to identify the areas of importance to our region and beyond. The Brainerd Lakes Area Chamber of Commerce has really been the catalyst behind this activity and will be very involved as we continue to move forward. And finally, the initiative will expand access to college courses for a larger percentage of high school students. The bulk of the courses will be concurrent courses, which means that high school faculty will be delivering the instruction in cooperation with faculty from Central Lakes College. And the two faculty groups have been working very closely together to identify the curriculum. At this time, I will turn it back to Pat for some more specifics on the project, on the initiative.
And Madam Chair, if I might. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so members, you have a red folder in front of you that has the information in it as well. I apologize for not putting that out at the beginning of the procedures. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ward. And Mr. Swartow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. The folder that John was referring to has a sheet in it that talks about the career academies and workplace connection bridges. The sheet that you have in front of you on the front side talks about what the bridges career academies are. There are a series of courses offered to the high school students in particular career pathways. Those particular pathways focus on the regional high demand, high pay growth areas. The curriculum is guided by college and high school faculty and industry advisors working together. The academies can be offered at multiple locations from the participating districts that you heard from Dr. Lundblad. The students are going to receive high school credit and college credit, dual credit. The work-based learning is an important required component of the academies. The academies include, and I'll refer you to two additional sheets in your folders, the ones that I'm holding up here. There's a sheet that shows the draft courses list for the Bridges Academies. The academies are Applied Engineering, Business and Administration, Manufacturing Technology, Health Science, and Nursing. It was through our research with DEED that we identified these five workforce areas as being the most critical in central Minnesota Brainerd Lakes area. And now I'll turn it over to Mr. Steve Rizidlo.
Welcome, Mr. Rizidlo. If you could restate your name for the
Madam team. Chair, thank you very much. Steve Rizidlo. I'm Assistant Superintendent in the Brainerd Schools. And I'm a former high school principal, and I'm very thankful for being able to talk about half of our request, or nearly half of our request, which is to help us begin and set up the workplace learning connection, which would capitalize on the Chamber of Commerce. We have a great Chamber of Commerce in Brainerd with the over 1,100 members, and the Chamber would like to be our one-stop shop for job shadows and internships. If you think about what inspires or what might motivate a high school student to take a look at a career pathway and to do so seriously, one of the things that we could best do is to get them out in a true connection and a systematically produced and monitored connection to business and industry. Our workplace learning connection would provide such an opportunity for hundreds of students. Or we could count handfuls right now in five school districts that have meaningful internships while students are in high school. Internships are more typically a college opportunity for students to get introduced to career pathways. We would like to turn those handfuls into hundreds and to have our Chamber of Commerce be able to undertake the planning and provisions necessary to make the workplace learning connection a reality in the central Minnesota region. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to introduce next Twyla Flaws, who is Head of Human Resources at Klaus Stamping.
Welcome, Ms. Flaws, and please restate your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Twyla Flaws, I'm the Personnel Manager at Klaus Stamping Company, 300-employee metal stamping and fabricating house. This is a collaborative that is business and industry driven. The representatives from business are over 1,200 in our area. It's a unique opportunity for collaboration employee shortages will be coming, particularly of qualified employees. That's a great concern to the businesses in our area. Children, students, and employees are our most precious resource. As with any resource that's short in commodity, we must learn to best utilize for the benefit of the resource and the user. We need to provide a path to success. This program will provide a path for the higher ed, the 25% at the top of the class, the 70% in the middle, and also for those children that have challenges that we need to have them succeed. Job shadows oftentimes show students and employees the areas in which they will be able to succeed when the mainline academic program is not working for them. We are absolutely confident that this pilot program will be a success. One of the things business is really looking forward to is the internship and the job shadowing. We need to know that our students have had a taste of what is out there and that they choose a vocation that they're willing to do and good at. It's a good fit for them. A lot of the expense for business will be the job shadows and interns. That's why the work connection is such an important part for us. I can't have 50 students or 100 students, or if this escalates, well, we want to thousands of students calling me to say, can I have an internship? But if we have a connector in the middle, that workforce connection can make those internships connections for us. And as employers, then we're willing to work with the educators to make these measurable internships for the children. We ask that you would fund our pilot and give us consideration. If you have any other questions or concerns, we'd be happy to address those.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to also recognize Dr. Joe Olpatz, who's in the audience, who is our colleague quite recently, who has now gone on to bigger and better things and is vice president at Central Lakes College. So welcome, Dr. Olpatz. We used to call you Representative Olpatz, but you got a better title. Representative. Anybody who wishes to testify for or against in the audience?
Madam Chair, can I just add a couple more things, and I thank you for representing.
Representative Ward, if you could hang on, because we're going to get the final word from you at the final end. Anybody from the audience that wishes to testify? Okay, nobody. Then Representative Heidberg, and I'll try one more time to see if you're listening. I called on you earlier.
Oh, I didn't even hear you.
I'm sorry.
Representative Dabney came in a little bit late, and I kind of...
Representative Dabney did
nice.
Just
Do I need a note from my parents?
thank you. Representative Ward, thank you for bringing this forward, and it is something that we have heard previously from the foreign languages and the fire ed. They're all trying to get into the high school system and reestablish the standards. The required standards. The governor's proposal of bringing electives down from 7 to 3. And I think you present a very good argument against foreign language as a requirement for 4 years. More than ever, 80% of your first graders will not graduate from college. So what is it saying? We're leaving 80% of our students aside. Not everybody's made for college. We need to have a skill level presented to them. I had a manufacturing lobbyist in my office yesterday complaining about the lack of people going into skilled areas, whether it's auto mechanics, when at all, computer, everything. Those are things that we introduce students to in the high school level. I think the pilot program we'll have here should be a requirement. It should be established throughout the state of Minnesota. Take some of our standards away. Take some of our requirements away to allow students to go into areas that they find interesting. 65% of the kids that graduate from high school do not graduate from college. I mean, they're even 65% behind.
You have a, that's just a comment. Okay.
Yes.
If you could spit yours out a little faster.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ward, thanks for bringing this forward. I'm just so happy to see that you have so many partnerships that are willing to work. That's great when you have so many people collaborating together to get this off the ground, and thank you for bringing this forward.
And Representative Dominguez asked to move the bill, but first we do have a quorum. I'll call the meeting to order. Representative Dominguez, would you like to move Representative Ward's bill?
I certainly would, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 983.
Representative Ward moves House File 983.
How about Representative Dominguez moves it?
Representative Dominguez moves Representative Ward's bill, House File 893, for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Gilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have a question for Representative Heigerkin. You are throwing those numbers around pretty rapidly. Did you say 85% of our fifth graders are not going to graduate from high school?
Or college.
From college.
Try not to encourage him, though. Representative Ward, you get the final word. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for... I always appreciate being called Representative Dominguez, being called Representative Ward. I want you to know that Representative Dominguez. I wanted to make a point about the cost, and Representative Hayek, thank you for your comments as well. And we ask for your support on this. We believe it's going to be a state. We want it to be a statewide project. The cost we're asking for, the cost on the back of the sheet is the cost of this program, a three-year pilot. And so that if you have questions on that, that's also on the back of the sheet. We just wanted to let you know that. We appreciate your support for this three-year pilot project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Ward, and all your testifiers. You're wonderful. You kept within your time limit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We have the minutes from March 14th, Representative Dietrich. I'm going to move the minutes. Representative Dietrich moves the minutes of March 14th. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Representative Vandell. And while he's going up there, I don't think it will be a big issue today, but I'm not sure. But yesterday I was very lenient in taking a lot of amendments. Some authors even brought their amendments right when they were presenting the bill. And I'm not going to do that today because we have an even fuller agenda. I want to get through the agenda. We're only going to take the amendments that made the deadline. And so if there's anybody who has other amendments, you'll have a perfect opportunity to do them when we mark up the bill next Tuesday, but not today. Representative Vanzell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is House File 1410.
And you're moving it?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Vanzell moves House File 1410 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Vanzell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly and quickly, for starters, I have an oral amendment. If I may?
I don't get it. I do get it. Oral amendments from the author if it's very short.
It's very short.
I'm very slow. He's
very
faster.
thank you. Line 12, after the word "its," insert 11th and 12th grade.
Is that it, Representative Vanzell?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair, as I promised.
All right. Representative Vanzell moves to amend his own bill on an oral amendment, line 112, after "its," insert 11th and 12th grade. Do you want to just incorporate that?
Yes, please.
All right. That is incorporated. Representative Vanzell.
Madam Chair and members, a long time ago, some 40 years ago, as a young classroom teacher, I really didn't have the appreciation for school superintendents and their creativity and their hard work that I do today. Seated with me today is Mr. Don Langan, who is a veteran school superintendent of several school districts throughout the state. He's currently at the helm at International Falls School District along the border in my district. And being the creative sort that he is, he gave me this idea for the creation of yet another new state aid and levy program, this one to be called Technical and Vocational Revenue. And essentially it is a very good bill in terms of its relationship to the previous comments by Representative Heidgerken. And with that, I turn it over to the creator of this, Representative Langan, for a brief explanation.
Representative Vanzell, is he really a representative?
No, he's a superintendent.
Okay. I thought so. Superintendent Langan, welcome, and thank you for driving all the way from International Falls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't know whether I was being elevated or not at the moment.
No, definitely not. And if you could please restate your name for the tape.
Don Langan, Superintendent of Schools, International Falls, Minnesota. Comment, if I could, Madam Chair and Committee, on some of the more critical points, I feel, in the House file you're considering at this point. We all know, and I don't think it takes an argument here, we all know what has happened to vocational funding over the last 25 years in this state. This is my 27th year as a state superintendent in Minnesota and my 43rd year in the business. I know that I well deserve. But what has happened is that not only have we seen a decline in the fiscal support for vocational career education in terms of just funding formula, we've also seen, in my judgment, a decline and a shift in how our culture, and I'm talking about our school culture, our community cultures, and culture at large, how we have viewed, for lack of a better term, the crafts, the trades, and the work that those professionals provide us. I don't know how many times I'll get calls after commencement from parents saddened. We went to the graduation parties, and I sure wished that my son or daughter was going to go to college. Or a year later, the youngster comes home after $4,000 or $5,000 of debt after one semester and says, "Dad, it's not for me." Parents are disappointed. Somehow or another, we've convinced ourselves and our kids and parents that being a professional craftsman, a professional tradesperson, is somewhat of less value. Quite frankly, Madam Chair, I think it's not less value. We are flat out demeaning it. What we're looking for here in this House file is to do two things. Number one, recognize that we're going to have some funding for vocational education. Secondly, that funding has got to come in some spirit of collaboration. I almost felt like we should have been in the party before us. What this would require for eligibility is that the school district must have a jointly approved program between the school district and its elected board and a post-secondary institution. In other words, this is an 11 through 14 concept. Very definitely. The other thing that I think is so critical is that even though we're looking at $250 per ADM, let's say 11th and 12th grade, that would generate about $50,000 in revenue for my school district. Where that is going to have to be needed is in recognizing that vocational and career-oriented apprenticeship-based programs are going to have to be 12-month programs. You don't shut down a voc ed career on the 31st of May and tell the kid, "I'll see you September 2nd. We're going to have those types of interrelationships and partnerships, not only with our post-secondary partners, but also with our trade and crafts union. We have visited with the millwrights, the carpenters, the plumbers, and the pipe fitters. We went in as a cadre of people and said one thing. We're teachers. We know how to teach it, but we don't know what it is. That's your job. You guys are the professionals. We can take the concept, the skills, the attributes, the knowledge, and we can form them into instructional packages. But we're looking at crafts and trades, not as advisory groups. We're looking for them as vested partners in this enterprise. The comment that was made about the value, I'll give you another statistic. I found it rather interesting. It's from the U.S. Department of Labor Apprenticeship Training. A journeyman pipe fitter, electrician, plumber, you name it. A journeyman craft or trades person today will have career earnings greater than 96% of all college graduates. And that's a fact, yeah. With that, Chairman, stand for any questions.
Thank you, Superintendent Langan. And I think we can apply Representative Hyde Gerken's comments to this bill as well, so we won't have to call on him again for this one. but I think they do apply very well, and thank you for your sincere, wise comments. Representative McFarland.
Yes, Madam Chair. And could you tell me what's happened with the Carl Perkins federal grant money over the years?
Superintendent Langan.
Madam Chair, the Carl Perkins money has not increased to the extent of the inflation of a piece of equipment. Our total allocation for ISD 361 for Carl Perkins this year was $8,100.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am strongly in support of this kind of venture. Having a 14-year-old living in my home with some special needs, many times over and over again we hear he's never going to college. That's devastating to hear as a parent, he's never going to college. And it is time that we start having options. Technical college is college. Technical skills is college, and it is time that we start having people understand that each and every member of our society can be a contributing member, and if we don't embarrass them, we're more likely to have them be productive members instead of on social service programs.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I really wish right now that the other group was back in here. I would have liked to have made this comment earlier, but I didn't. It seems like the type of model that you are talking about just exemplifies the whole 3 hours, 4 hours high school program that actually I will be presenting that bill later tonight in education policy and here tomorrow. And so it truly does demonstrate what I have just been learning in the past couple of weeks, though, about that the high school model. So there are very wise people like you out there already working on this issue and have started to pave the way for solutions. And so I thank you for bringing that solution here today.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I understand that there was an amendment and we changed this to just 11th and 12th graders for the levy.
Representative Demmer, that's right. So the fiscal note obviously is not.
That was my question. Right. Do we have any numbers on that?
We don't. So if we go forward with this bill, we'll definitely have to get one. And Representative Dietrich, and,
sure.
Well, they have it already.
Crow has that look in his eye like I can take a shot at this.
All right. Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, members, the 11th and 12th grade population is about 16.5% on average over the four-year period of the total enrollment on an ADM basis, and so the levy cost would, instead of $164 million, would be about $27 million a year based on that, and the aid cost would be about $5 million in 2009, and then drop down as property values rise in 10 and 11, be about 4.4 in 10 and 3.2 in 11.
Thank you. That was very quick. There aren't any other questions, but members, there's many bills that we hear that do overlap with each other, and when we do finally put together our omnibus bill very, very soon, some of these bills could team up and work together, and then we have win-wins for more than one bill rather than all of them separately when there's overlapping topics. Representative Grockwell, you get the final question.
Thanks. It's actually a question for Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom.
That's the final question. Mr. Strong, pay attention here.
The language in the bill regarding the equalization, regarding the ratio of district referendum market value, is that the same as the operating right now? Okay, thanks.
For the record, that was a head nod. Very good. Thank you, Rep. Evansell, Superintendent Langan. I hope you're going to do something else down here as well for that long trip down.
There's many other creative ideas for bills.
Very, very fine. And Representative Ansel, did you have any closing comment you wanted to make?
Just very, very briefly, having had some experience in the building trades, I can tell you that the pressures are huge to attract and recruit young men and women into all of the building trades. And this is a problem that can best be met in a collaborative fashion, and they are very, very interested in this kind of language.
Excellent. Thank you. And our House File 1410 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Tilbury.
Madam Chair.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 808 if I might for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 bill.
Representative Morrow moves House File 808 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome, Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for allowing me the chance to bring this forth.
I'm excited about this particular bill. I've been excited about this long before the election and so on. This has been many years coming for me to be able to come before you and talk about this. One of the things that I do want to do is I want you to think, now some of you have a little bit of, you've heard this before because you had this in the policy committee, but I wanted to share it with the members that didn't hear this before. I have some statements that were made by students that came into my office, and I have 10 of them. And what I'm going to do is read each one of them to you, and I want you to think about how much time it would take to solve that dilemma or to solve a problem that that student came forth with. And I just would be curious to see what you might say. The first statement that someone, it was actually a 15-year-old girl that walked my office, and she said this: "My mom's boyfriend told me that I'm starting to look better than my mom. How can I go live with my dad? How much time would that take?" Number two, "My friend called me last night at 3 a.m. and said he didn't want to live anymore. That's why I kept falling asleep in class last hour." Once again, how much time would that take? Number three, "This one kid pulled my gym shorts down in gym class today and everyone laughed at me." Once again, how much time? Another one, "I think I'm pregnant and if my dad finds out, he's going to kill me." Another one, "My girlfriend might be pregnant and I don't know what to do. I'm afraid this guy is going to put pictures of me and him on the internet doing some sex stuff. Now he wants me to do it with his friends. If I don't, he'll send it out on the internet." When I asked how long this might have been going on, she said 1.5 years. "My mom told me that she's leaving my dad today. If that kid talks to me or even looks at me, he's going to get hurt. I'm just warning you. If my teacher gets on me about homework again, I'm going to hit her. My mom hit me last night with the phone when I tried to call 911. These are all true, and I could come up with several more. And I shared these with some of the staff members of our student support service team just to make sure that they would be okay with the things that I might share. And they said those happen every day. Another situation I got off my notes that I kept. "Girl wants to hurt herself, suicidal, has a plan worked out after school. After initial assessment, suggestion is made for parent to pick up student, go to emergency room." And no lie, this is actual stuff. Parent's response was, "I have bread in the oven now, do I have to come right away?" 3 years ago, I had separate students talking seriously about suicide, and I had at least one student a week for 17 straight weeks. That's amazing. One student every time, every week, for 17 straight weeks as we kept track of it. There were times that about 2:30, a colleague would come to me and say, it's 2:30, you might get by this week without having anybody. And sure enough, just as fast as that comment came out, a student came in. We couldn't believe it. I just want to say one item before I turn it over to my testifiers. Please don't be fooled into thinking that Student Support Services only deals with careers.
Thank you, Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Representative Tilbury. Dr. Walters, rather.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Walter Roberts, Jr. I'm a professor of counselor education at Minnesota State University, Mankato, and I'm very, very pleased to have the opportunity to share this information with you today. Many of you on this committee have heard me testify before in the previous committee prior to today, so I will not repeat that testimony. I would, however, like to highlight some information that I want to emphasize. You also have been given in your packets of material quite a bit of information related to the student services professions, and I hope that when you have the opportunity, I hope that you will have the opportunity to review that, because it does, I think, give some additional dramatic information related to many of the things that the student services personnel do. While I'm here today to respond to any particular questions that you might have, I really want to emphasize several three points in particular. First, if we truly intend to leave no child behind, then we must acknowledge that children are more than the sum of their test scores. They come to our schools with different levels of readiness, different levels of opportunity, and with a diversity that Minnesota could not imagine 20 years ago. Student support personnel respond to those aspects of a child's personal and social development, the emotional and physical well-being that lend themselves to increased chances of academic success in the classroom. Second, Minnesota has fallen behind in its provision of student services personnel to help children address those areas in their lives which impede academic progress. If we don't respond with a sufficient fiscal note to this bill, more than likely this time next year, Minnesota will be dead last in the access of students to school counseling services. Additionally, just last month, Minnesota was flagged as deficient in the number of school nurses needed to meet recommended federal guidelines. Cracks in the emotional and physical well-being of our children ultimately are reflected in their ability to learn. It is just that simple. According to the Minnesota Student Survey, in 6 years between 1998 and 2004, our state sees progress when we invest in those areas of the emotional and physical health that need attention. One good example is the issue of teen tobacco use. The emphasis that our state placed on helping children learn about the dangers associated with tobacco use during those periods of time yielded a significant downward trend in those individuals who took the survey. This bill holds the promise of allowing schools to increase the use of student services personnel to focus on many more at-risk issues among children and adolescents, the reduction of which will only increase their abilities to learn and achieve both in and outside the K-12 domain.
You know, we have about 3 minutes left, and I know there's two more tests.
That is fine. In closing, let me just simply say this. Each generation paves the future for its children by what we do today, and I hope that a strong fiscal note attached to this particular bill will help us pave the way for that future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Roberts. I know you worked on this bill many years, and
hopefully we
can do something with it this year. Welcome, Dr. Maves.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Ralph Maves, and I'm here this afternoon representing the Minnesota School Psychologists Association and speaking in support of House File 808. I do need to mention before proceeding further that in the latest issue of U.S. News and World Reports magazine, which just came out this week, school psychology is listed as one of the 10 hottest careers which young people can enter into. So if you have any sons or daughters who are looking toward an occupation. I have been working here at the legislature for the past 8 years, and I want to say that House File 808 is a piece of legislation which some of us have been looking forward to for a long time, one that has been and is badly needed. We speak often of the achievement gap, leaving no student behind, having higher academic standards, having more course rigor, having students be prepared to compete in the global economy. For a number of students, this will be quite easily doable. They will be at the higher end of the achievement ladder. They will meet the higher academic standards. They'll deal with greater course rigor. They will be ready to compete in the global economy. They will not be left behind. However, for a significant number of other students, these are things which are not attainable without support along the way, from kindergarten through 12th grade. Some of the most important supports some of these students will receive will be those from student support service personnel. It may be the support of a school counselor, school social worker, school psychologist, school nurse, school chemical health worker. Oftentimes, it will be the support of two or more of these services working in concert, along with administrators, teachers, parents, and students themselves. To make these supports possible, student support services personnel must be present in sufficient numbers. To give one quick example from my own experience, I was able to work in a very fine school district with a number of resources. However, during my last 6 years working at the high school of that district, I was the only psychologist for 2,200 students. The ratio of school psychologists to students usually is cited at 1 to 1,000. In closing, I'd just like to say that Commissioner Segrin said on public radio in the last week and a half, when she was discussing educational issues, she said, and I quote, "The students are moving through the system. We need to have supports for them all along the way." I could not agree more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please state your name for the record as well.
Welcome. Thank you. My name is Colleen Valdrica, and I am a school counselor, and I am president-elect for Minnesota School Counselors Association. And what I just want to say is that this bill will allow students' services, support services, school nurses, social workers, counselors, chemical health psychologists work together, and we collaborate out there right now, but each district has a shortage, and this will allow for the new counselors and social workers and chemical health and nurses to be hired, so I please consider giving it a nice fiscal amount.
Thank you very much, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tilbury, I see that this is an appropriation primarily for 2008 and 2009. What if in 2010 and 2011 there are not funds available, because you do have the clause, the commissioner shall make aid payments only to the extent that appropriate funds are available. What if this gets in the omnibus bill and it passes? What are you going to do when the money's not available?
And
you put this program in place.
Well, I'd always be open for the suggestion to have it continue forever and ever, but I also know reality too. Whereas I would like to have a specific dollar amount that I could put in and say every single year this should be added on to it. But I also know realistically that that may or may not happen. I'm looking at the first 2 years at this point, and I'm leaving it up to the chair to extend off into the future if we can do it. I would be back here again if we don't have more of this.
It's always a challenge what we fund and what is ongoing, and those are the kinds of things we'll be discussing when we mark up the omnibus bill. You make a very good point, Representative Erickson. Something like this really should be ongoing. Is there any testimony from the audience for or against the bill? Okay, thank you very much, Representative Tilbury. Representative Morrow renews his motion that House File 808 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you for all the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson. Representative Morrow, are you moving these bills?
Chair Garland, I'd be happy to move House File 1699 for possible inclusion.
Representative Morrow moves House File 1699 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair, let's start over again here. I think there is a technical amendment. I'm doing 1699.
Right, Representative Peterson, I think your amendment is to 1701,
right,
and
right.
Representative Morrow is moving that one, which is, but I mixed you up by having him introduce this bill. But we're on your one right now, 1699.
Okay. All right, we're doing one at a time.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for hearing these bills. You know, it was an unusual set of circumstances that we have these two bills before you. They really deal with the same issue, but they're different funding streams. And so we will talk about each of the options you have, which is wonderful. You have two options of how to fund this program. This is a very worthwhile program, in my opinion. And the first one on 1699 deals with, all of these deal with high mobility high schools or secondary schools, and we know what a difference it makes when you have high mobility and a turnover rate that is astounding in schools. This particular bill would provide grants if you have 25% mobility and over 100 students in grades 9 through 12, and it allows the commissioner to make those grants, and there would be one grant per qualified school district on a first-come, first-served basis, and of course this would not have tails, and so might be more appealing. And with that, I brought two testifiers for each of these, and this is Jeff McGonigal, who's the principal of Cooper High School, which is one of those high mobility high schools. We're a first-ring suburb, as you know, right next to Minneapolis. And we also have Allison Ray, who's a counselor, and they're prepared to give you some information as to why we should add support for this bill.
Representative Peterson, you have, these are the same two testifiers for both bills?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to have you kind of give your general testimony. It probably is, and then we won't hear from you again on the second bill. We'll just hear how that's different. Mr. McDonagall.
McDonagall.
It's St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you.
And I want to personally say hello to some faces familiar to me from communities I've served in previously, too. Thank you. I came to...
And excuse me, if you could please also restate your
I'm
name.
I'm sorry, Jeff McGonigal, and I'm the principal of Cooper High School in the Robbinsdale School District. I came to Robbinsdale Cooper High School a year and a half ago unaware of an issue that is profound in both how it affects students and actually the size of the issue in our school and in some other high schools. And I'm not going to read something that I think you have that's titled Robbinsdale High School on the first page, but I do want to bring your attention to three bullets on the first page. Concentrations of highly mobile students exist and is growing in some Minnesota schools, particularly those in the urban core such as North Minneapolis, St. Paul, and suburban communities bordering North Minneapolis, including Robbinsdale. Highly mobile students not having the benefit of a carefully articulated K-12 curriculum scope and sequence exhibit extraordinary gaps in their educational knowledge and skills. These gaps contribute in large part to difficulty of assimilating to a new school and to the students' personal expectations for school success. And thirdly, concentrations of highly mobile students place extraordinary demands on the school administration as they enroll, register, and orient each student to his or her new school, and on the teachers as they help each student settle into the educational program. To give you an example, Cooper High School has an enrollment just over 1,900 students. Since August, we've had over 620 new students arrive at Cooper. At the same time, about the same number of students have departed. That's what makes up 32% mobility, and you'll see on the top of the second page graphs showing the changes of mobility in our school district. Cooper is the column second from the right, and you'll see it's increasing and now up to 32.2%. Our sister school, Armstrong, which is a little bit further to the west, has about half that mobility. The index below, that explains the top, I think it's about 12 high schools above 25% mobility, and then a random sample of the rest of the schools just to show you some comparisons for other communities you might be familiar with. And Cooper is the blue line, and there are three schools with higher mobility than we have. And the third page talks about the success of Robbinsdale students, and what this graph shows, there is an achievement gap. But there is also steady increase in scores for students in our school district if they stay in our school district for 5 years. The population not shown here are the students who are struggling so badly, and those are our students that are highly mobile. The fourth page I am going to read briefly because it puts a personal tone to the topic. One number I did want to throw out as well, we got a new fax machine in our guidance office in December a year ago, so this would be about 13 months ago. Since it arrived, due to mobility, it scanned 28,000 pages and printed 29,000 pages. That's the extent to which this mobility is affecting our guidance office, helping new students. New students arrive at Robbinsdale Cooper High School on a daily basis, often without notifying the school of their intention and often without the certainty of a home address. The family is often unsure of the student's immunization record, accumulated credits, grade history, or special education status. The family typically does not arrive with the necessary supporting paperwork. The student's cumulative record, CUM folder, is not typically obtained from the previous school for weeks, if at all, often because the previous school is still waiting for the records themselves, often from another state. The phone number provided by the family is not always accurate or active. Counselors work quickly to greet, meet, and support the student, typically working without the benefit of important personal or academic history. There is little time for proper explanation of the course offerings, for the discussion of the student's goals for post-secondary education, or for the discussion of the alignment of the high school courses to future educational goals. There is little time for a proper explanation of the student's daily schedule. There is little time to chat about the opportunities for engagement in extracurricular activities or other events that are designed to support students' sense of belonging in school. New textbooks and assignments are often provided and a chair made available by a departing student is assigned, sometimes without proper attention to the process of relationship building, a key factor in school engagement. The content or sequence of the curriculum does not typically match that which they left behind only 2 days earlier. As with any new learning, the brain searches for connections on which to build new knowledge. When a connection cannot be found, new learning is often diminished or quickly lost. Consequently, the highly mobile student moves from class to class without the prior knowledge that is necessary for success. Some faces in the hallway are familiar, as other mobile students have recently made the same move. This story is fictitious, but dramatizes what's happened at Cooper 600 plus times already this school year.
And okay. Allison Ray can just maybe add some comments from a counselor's perspective.
Thank you. Ms. Ray, if you could identify yourself for the tape and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Allison Ray, licensed school counselor at Robbinsdale Cooper High School. And just in general, the job of a counselor is to promote success for all students and to work in a proactive way to help them with the things that they're working on. The impact that these highly mobile students have on how I do my job on a daily basis is apparent from the story Mr. McGonigal read. Establishing relationships with families that we don't know their history. We don't know their strengths. We don't know their academic history. We have no transcripts often when they come. The administrative paperwork takes a lot of time to get familiar with these students and be able to help support them in the way they need. Also to orient them to the school and get them familiar with rules and to get them feeling comfortable and know their ways through the hallway takes time. All of this impacts how much work we're doing with all of our students in the building. Time on college planning, time on transition work, time with mental health issues. It's a hard balance to maintain. The other issue is being proactive and working with all students. And because we don't know what's coming through our doors, it's very hard to be proactive given these highly mobile students. One just personal example that I had last month, I registered a new student who had been at two previous high schools throughout his high school experience, and he is currently a senior, a special ed student who was behind on credits. When I registered him, I did not have any special education records. I didn't have his transcripts. But through talking to him, we put him in classes. We set him up to be reevaluated for special ed services in our district, and we got him going, got him on track. Got to know him a little bit, helped him find his classes, helped him find his way. Unfortunately, this week, after I finally tracked down his transcripts and got his credits all in order, our secretaries were putting him into the system. He was in getting his withdrawal paperwork to move on to another school. And the relationship that I just worked to establish with him, unfortunately, it ended Monday when he withdrew. So that's just a personal example that recently happened to me.
Thank you very, very much. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Robbinsdale School District is also one of the school districts I represent. I have, if you look at the chart, Robbinsdale, Osseo, Brooklyn Center would be up in this chart, but it's not on there. And then I have parts of Anoka-Hennepin. So three of the four high schools that I represent are up in this high mobility. The number one reason for mobility in my city is eviction from the apartments. People get into an apartment they can't afford. They're there for a short time. Within 3 months, they're evicted. One of my son's friends was in and out of the elementary school four times in the same school year. And so this is a serious issue, and thank you for coming to share your story.
Thank you very much, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, you know, in Representative Tilbury's bill, he's very specific about his dollars being limited to salary and benefit costs. But your language is just puzzling me a little bit, so I need to ask you, what do you mean by... This grant program is established to provide additional student counseling services. Are you talking about also using your dollars for the salaries and benefits, or do you have something else in mind?
No, this Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, this is for salary and benefits for counselors, and licensed school counselors.
Thank you. Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just looking over the charts here. Could you please tell me in Cooper, Robbinsdale area, what portion of minority students are enrolled in your school?
At Robbinsdale Cooper High School, it's about 45%.
Hey, by the way, our committee administrator went to Cooper. All right, class. All right, any testimony for or against the bill from the public? Okay, House File, Representative Morrow moves his motion to consider House File 1699 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Morrow.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 1701 be held over for possible inclusion, and then, Madam Chair, there's also an amendment.
Okay.
for House File 1701.
Thank you, Rep. Zamora. Rep. Zamora moves House File 1701 be laid over or be moved for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Rep. Zamora now moves Amendment A1.
I do, Madam Chair. I move the A1 amendment is a technical change on lines 1.17, removing the two words, the greater.
Technical amendment A1. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Peterson, the bill is now in the shape that you want it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, if I had the choice, I would like to amend that it would be licensed before all of the school counselors. That was a technical amendment, too.
Representative Peterson, is that on line one?
It's throughout throughout the document. Wherever you see school counselors, just add licensed.
Madam Chair, I will move that the word license be inserted before the phrase school counselors on line 1.9, on line 1.16, 1.17. And if anyone sees if I've missed one, I'd be happy to add that as well.
Rep. Zamora moves an oral amendment.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, and 2.9, Mr. Crow tells me.
Okay, Representative Zamora moves an oral amendment that we add the words license before school counselors on line 1.9, 1.16, 1.17, and 2.9. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Peterson, your time is actually up, but you can tell us how this bill... she has more time?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I will be very quick. Actually, this is very similar. It would provide a permanent funding stream if you have between 20 and 40% mobility and 100 or more students. And that, I think, is a very unique way of trying to address a problem that certainly needs to be addressed, and it kind of narrows at least the number of counselors that we would have in particular districts. I think this is also a good way of addressing it because we don't have to come back every 2 years to try to find money for this very worthy cause. And as already has been stated, this is kind of the counselor's day. We've already talked about the need for counselors. We need career counselors. We need counselors for mobility. We need counselors for, you know, the kinds of crisis issues that come up. You've already heard all the reasons, and so I think... It's one that we ought to begin addressing, and this is certainly a way you can do that. And with that, I would like to ask for your support for both of these bills to be considered.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. And I've just been apprised that it looks... Okay, well, anyway, we have a little more time, possibly, than I thought. So, we have had a lot of testimony on counselors and school support staff, and obviously there's a need, and we heard these bills in policy as well, and now you brought the option of high mobility and various types of revenue. So we have more options on the table, and we do have a question from Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crow, I think this would be for you, maybe Mr. Strom, but I realize that this will be if this is adopted and placed into statute, that this would be an additional line item. How would the MARS reporting work?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, the printout shows the relative costs for each district. This would be a categorical revenue to the school district as part, a component of general education revenue. So in terms of the revenue component, that would flow to the district just as general education would. The bill on line 2.9 of the bill says that the revenue must be spent by the school board for school counselors. So the school district would have to set up a designated account to spend that money. They wouldn't have to reserve it for that purpose, but they would have a designated account with the new money that this generates. And according to the initial printout estimate, that'd be about $4.2 million a year.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Any testimony for or against the bill from the audience? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to add one thing, that is that this appears to be a real issue around housing, as already was stated. And also, Mr. McGonigal, the principal, also would, I think, could just real quickly
talk about which schools, or talk about the issue of the schools that they rotate to? It's been a
sure. If you look at the school, I'm sorry. Thank you. Madam Chair. The schools that you see on that chart can be organized geographically, a number of them around the North Minneapolis area. So it is not unusual for us to see a student leave and go to one of those other schools of high mobility and then return. Interestingly, my wife works at Blaine High School, and she had a family she was working with that had an eviction issue, and they were looking at their different options on what could they do to stay in at Blaine High School. And when they were sizing up all their opportunities, it looked like they were going to be moving into the Cooper attendance area. So it does have to do with where the affordable housing exists geographically.
Thank you very much. Representative Peterson, do you have a final comment?
No, I just think this is a very worthy cause and deserves your full attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think this topic does have our full attention. Thank you for the testifiers. And Representative Norton.
Yes.
No. Representative Norton, welcome to the committee. You're busy today. You're in policy this morning with another bill. Do you have a mover of your amendment, or should I move it?
If you would move it, that would be delightful.
All right, I'll move House File 984 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Norton.
Chair Garling, members, I'm asking for your support of House File 984, and I'm wondering if you might allow me to make an author's amendment. Verbal. There isn't one written.
What is it, Representative Norton?
I've had some calls from some teachers, and they're suggesting that online, well, I won't even put you on your line, after the term ACT-SAT test fees, that we insert after test or test prep fees not to exceed $100. The teacher's rationale was that perhaps...
Okay, let me just get it. We have to get it first. Say, what you're trying to after test these, how many times does this appear in here?
Two. Oh, one time.
Okay. I see two test fees.
It would just be test or test prep fees.
Test or test prep is on line 1.14. It's on 1.16, and it's on 1.23. So, members, the oral amendment is on line 1.14 after test, put for test prep, and then the same on 1.16, and the same on 1.23. Does anyone see it anywhere else?
Chair Garling, I'd like to, if I could put not to exceed $100, because I do believe you can take test prep for up to $1,000 if you want, but there are online versions and other ones that are much less expensive.
So after all three of those places, not to exceed $100. Representative Norton's staff is asking, are you sure you want to limit the test or test prep fee to $100?
No, I only wanted to limit the test prep fees to $100.
Then we don't have it quite right. So I think we're going to hear the bill. Skip this amendment because I did say no amendments, and this one's too complicated. So
perfectly
should this
fine.
Bill proceed, we will get it amended in
perfectly
the omnibus bill. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Chair Riley. I did not mean to complicate matters that much. It just seemed like a good idea. The state of Minnesota has approximately 252,633 students on free and reduced lunch, and at that level, it means there are a number of students in each grade level, roughly 19,000 students on free and reduced lunch, who taking a test like the ACT or SAT would be a financial difficulty for the child and their family. And what this bill does is allow the schools to be reimbursed for each student on free and reduced lunch that would like to take the test up to two times. And so we're just asking for your support. We know that in the state of Minnesota, and certainly in my community, as an example, with 27.7% on free and reduced lunch, this would be a benefit to those students, encourage more students to go to college and think about college as a possibility. And you can't go to college without taking one of these tests. So if we can get students to take it, they do well, they'll consider college.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, baseball has a designated hitter, and it looks like this committee has the designated testifier. I've been here several times this week. And so I would say I'm very much in support of Representative Norton's bill, not only as schools as executive director of schools for equity and education, but also as a parent of senior high children and seeing the sticker shock I'm getting from these test fees. And I make good income. I can only imagine, though, that sticker shock is much more keen for people at lower income levels. And so I think what Representative Norton is doing is a step in the right direction, certainly a help for opening up college doors to children of all income levels.
Thank you very much. And we do have an amendment. Who has Amendment A1? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Representative Erickson moves the A1 amendment. Members have that. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because of my research on the website of the College Board and ACT, I found that students who have or qualify for free and reduced are eligible for free waiver cards to cover the basic test fees and to cover the question and answer service. I thought it would be good to provide an incentive for other students who are public or non-public who also receive free and reduced price lunch to or that kind of local waiver to have their test paid for if they score 20 or higher on the ACT or 1,000 or higher on the SAT. So I'm qualifying what Representative Norton wants to do because I find that there is a waiver for others, and so we could separate those two out.
Representative Norton.
Chair Darling and members, I appreciate the comments. I'm not in favor of this amendment. It changes the scope of what I'm trying to do, and I want to encourage students to take the test, not have it be a detriment if they don't do well, and nor do I want to reach beyond the free and reduced lunch students. So I think it changes the scope of this bill, and I ask that you not support the amendment.
Rep. and Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I, too, am going to speak against the amendment. Working with students in test preparation every semester, the last thing I think we need to do, or at least we need to be worried about, is increasing test anxiety for those for whom cost would also be a detriment. Certainly, I agree with Representative Erickson, there may be another option for a fee waiver, although that process sometimes can be daunting to students as well. So I am going to speak against the amendment in part because I don't want to discourage the very students that I believe Representative Norton has said attempting to encourage.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Greiling. You know, I'm just trying to be a little more responsible with the taxpayers' dollars here, and because students can get the waiver through the College Board for the SAT and through ACT, this would be, you know, a little different approach and probably fiscally more responsible. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call.
Representative Erickson requests a roll call. Is there any further discussion? Representative Morgan.
Yes, Madam Chair. I guess I'm not clear as to the amendment author's intent. It sounded to me, Representative Erickson, in your explanation, that you're trying to expand the group for whom this is available, but it looks to me as I read this as the amendment would actually reduce the group to whom this rebate or refund is available. Could you clarify that for me, please?
Madam Chair, well, what my amendment does is it limits state funds to just those students who would receive a 20 or higher or 1,000 and higher in the SAT because they can already qualify for the waiver. So this separates out what we're going to use state dollars for, because already the waiver is available through the College Board and through the ACT.
So Representative Erickson is looking to have it be a reward for students who get high scores, and if they don't, they don't. Representative Hillstrom, and then Representative Anzels, and then we will take the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, would speak against the amendment. I think that... I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was distracted here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would speak against the amendment for one of two reasons. One is because the score is a pressure point. But number two is students already in the high school years, there are less and less that apply for free and reduced lunch. And we become more and more aware at our high schools that they're not doing it. Much of it is about pride and about embarrassment. And the more things we do or make students do to interfere with them getting these kinds of services, I think it does cause more of a problem. So I would encourage a no vote on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Benzel.
Madam Chair and members, I too would encourage a no vote just simply because I too am concerned about taxpayers, but this seems to be the kind of investment that state tax dollars should be directed toward, especially in comparison with some of the other things we do around here.
Thank you. There's been a roll call requested. The clerk will call the roll.
Greiling?
No.
Enzel?
No.
Benson?
No.
Brown?
No.
Dabney?
No.
Semmer?
Pass.
Detmer?
Yes.
Dietrich?
No.
Dominguez?
No.
Erickson?
Yes.
Bo?
No.
Garofalo?
No.
Heidbirken? Hillstrom?
No.
Mariani? Marquardt? McFarland?
No.
Morgan?
No.
Morrow?
No.
Olson, Swale. Demmer?
No.
There are two ayes and 15 nays. The amendment is not adopted. Is there any testimony on this bill for or against from the public other than what we've had? Okay, Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I guess Representative Erickson did make a lot of my point. I'm questioning, and I agree with the spirit and the intent of this bill, Representative Norton. I think we're probably on the same page on that when we want kids to take these tests. And quite frankly, we want them to take them more than once sometimes. My own daughters have done them even more than two. And I think it's a great option. But there are, as we look at, Madam Chair and members, as we look at resources that we're utilizing, there are waiver fees available through the College Board Admission Test for both these tests. You can take it up to twice, each of these tests up to two times with the waiver fees for with the same kind of qualifications. I realize there may be some process to that, but you know there's process to taking the test to begin with. You have to register ahead of time, and usually you're done weeks ahead of time for that. You have to send in your fee or apply for the waiver. I'm just not sure that we need to usurp what's available already without state dollars with state dollars when we know we get at least two waivers available per student. So I guess I would have to speak against the bill, not because it's not the right thing to be doing, but because it's already available, and I'm not sure we have to use the state dollars to do something that's already available through the College Board.
Representative Norton, last word.
Mr. Garling, we certainly, and I would anticipate every high school, would certainly encourage students to continue to do that. There isn't money in the College Boards to fund every child either. This is one opportunity. We have children that we desperately need to go to college in this state, and I would encourage a yes vote on the bill.
Thank you very much. House File 984 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Norton. Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon Cleandown, would you answer a question for me? Is somebody on this? Where would the waiver money come from? I'm just very curious about that. That's not state funds.
The waiver.
Where would the what money come from?
The waiver money.
Within the college. Where does the money from the College Board come from?
Mr. Crow. Mr. Strong.
Representative Dietrich, if we could get back to you in a minute. We're just landing at the website about this.
Okay. No, I just want to know for future reference. Thank
Representative McFarland, do you know the answer?
I had looked that up, and I think both ACT and SAT have programs for waivers themselves. It was through their programs, so I'm not sure exactly.
We're going to stop with this, and we'll if we get the answer after Representative Simon's bill, we will go to it. Representative Simon, welcome to the committee. Is anyone moving your bill?
It's up to you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'll move House File 1850 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome, and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I know that you have a lot of bills before you, a lot of worthy causes. I am here to ask for a one-time matching grant, to sustain success in our urban schools.
Did we hear one time?
One time, and I hope that's particularly enticing. One time, a one-time grant, and a matching grant at that. So no something for nothing here. It's a fair trade, a one-time matching grant for success, to sustain success in our urban schools. And this is specifically matching money for the Minnesota Urban Debate League. Its fiscal agent is Augsburg College, obviously a reputable and responsible institution. And this has been around for several years, and I think we ought to reward and sustain this success, which you'll hear about in a couple of minutes, and in very short order, with very little time, I hope, about the successes here. This is a group, Minnesota Urban Debate League, that is providing skills and opportunities and, most of all, hope and success for kids in our urban schools. And let me just make very clear, this will not affect my district whatsoever. I represent St. Louis Park and Hopkins, and they have thriving debate and speech programs. I was part of one of them at Hopkins High School class of 1988. And it really helped me, I think, in life, my participation in debate and speech, and we ought to have those opportunities for kids. And I'll just be blunt, it shouldn't just be white suburban kids that get these opportunities. So it's no skin off of my nose in terms of my district. It's not going to affect kids in Hopkins and St. Louis Park. But I think this is about making sure that kids all over the state have these opportunities. Now, with some reticence, I draw your attention to the packet that you received, the folder, and I know you've got a lot of paper. But behind the blue sheet is a Star Tribune editorial. I say I'm reticent about it because there's some people in the room for whom a Star Tribune editorial might push them the other way, and I understand that. Nonetheless, I was very proud that 2 weeks ago or so, this appeared in the Minneapolis paper. It's a staff editorial endorsing this proposition, endorsing the bill that's before you today, and you can read it at your leisure. Suffice it to say that it's a very worthy program, as are all the programs that you've had before you today and will continue to have before you. Instead of myself just talking about the successes, I'd like to turn it over to the frontline folks who really know something about this. And let me introduce you, Madam Chair and members, and she can introduce herself for the record, to Karen Guerin of the Minnesota Urban Debate League.
Welcome, Ms. Guerin. Please restate your name for the tape.
Yes, my name is Karen Guerin. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Urban Debate League. And thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm sure that every member of this committee is aware of the report published by Education Week, which stated that only 43.6% of the black students in the state of Minnesota graduate from high school. This is in contrast to the graduation rate of white students, which is 83.1%. The fact that this is one of the largest achievement gaps in the entire nation is cause for considerable public embarrassment and frustration in a state that prides itself on the quality of its schools. Today, I will argue that academic debate has proven itself to be one of the most powerful educational tools available to address this problem. I will present evidence that has emerged across the entire country in support of this statement, and I will introduce data from our own test results. The Minnesota Urban Debate League is part of a larger network that began in the 1990s in an effort to improve public school education across the country. There are now Urban Debate Leagues in 17 major cities, including New York, Atlanta, Baltimore, and Chicago. The results of their work has consistently been impressive, and it suggests that what they have accomplished can be replicated across the country. Highlights of these results include the fact that Urban Debate League students, or debaters, improved their grades by 8 to 10% a year as a result of their involvement in debate. Their literacy scores increased 25% at a 25% higher rate than that of non-debaters after 1 year's involvement in the program. But more significantly for the issue that we're addressing here, 90% of Urban Debate League students graduate from high school, and 75% of them attend four-year colleges. In June of 2003, Leslie Stahl did a 60 Minutes report on the Urban Debate Program in Baltimore. I hope you had a chance to see it. It was really stunning. She stated that many educators believe debate is a better learning tool for urban students than anything else they've tried. And shortly after her report, not only did Baltimore's Urban Debate League get public funding, but as a result of that funding, they were recently recognized in the President's State of the Union message as one of the best after-school programs in the entire country. With your support, we have the potential to replicate this success. Of the 15 high schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul, only three had debate programs in 2003. Now in our fourth year of existence, the Minnesota Urban Debate League has initiated programs in five high schools and two middle schools, and we are working with the public schools to integrate debate into the classroom curriculum. During this time, we've also completed 2 years of research in one of the most challenging high school environments in the Twin Cities, North High. The testing was conducted independently by the leading expert on urban debate leagues in the country.
Excuse me, Ms. Garrett, I'm just going to let you know we have one more bill after this, and we have to be out of this room at 1:45. So since there's another testifier, if you could summarize real quickly so we could get testifier in. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would like to summarize with the results we've experienced. North's debaters improved their reading skills by 36% in a single year. Our testing consultants conservatively states that this is the equivalent of more than three grade levels. After 1 year of debate, students averaged 17% higher self-esteem than their peers, and the differential increased with their years of participation. In a community where only 43% of the black students graduate, all of our debaters have graduated on time and plan to attend college. Debaters were also three times less likely than their peers to engage in risk behavior.
Thank you, Ms. Guerin. The next testifier, if you could introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Sure. My name is Robert Groven. I'm an associate professor of communication studies at Oxford College. I'm also the director of the honors and the forensics programs there. I also was a debate coach for 20 years. I myself am the product of urban debate. I did debate at Como Senior High over in St. Paul. And I can tell you that what I wanted to tell you, Karen can give you the statistics, you can look at the statistics, but what I want you to understand is from an individual level, as somebody who has both been an urban debater and who has coached and worked with thousands of these students over 20 years, that there is a fundamental transformation in the way a student raised in an urban environment thinks about themselves. And when I was talking to Tracy Beckman, who's a former representative who's now working at Augsburg, and he and I were talking about how when I was in high school, there was a thriving debate community in the urban areas. And now there's virtually none absent the Urban Debate League program. And what that means is that it has raised a fundamental issue of public policy, that those skills that make a student part of the democratic process, those skills that make a student feel powerful to be part of our civilization, to be part of our business, those are systematically being given to those who are in private schools and affluent suburban schools, but are not being given to students in urban schools, and in particular to minority groups and to first-time college generation. And if we could do that, you would be able to create a pathway that would fundamentally change the way education happens in our state, because those students go into classrooms with non-debaters. They seed that classroom, and they create a chain reaction in which the dynamic in the classroom and dynamic in the school becomes ones where academics is interesting. Debate is the only activity I know where research becomes cool and exciting and interesting to high school teenagers.
Mr. Groven, we can see your enthusiasm.
Yep.
Representative Simon persuaded
Thanks.
Us to get a hearing if it would be 5 minutes, so we're now on to 10. So we're going to cut you off right there. Is there any testimony for or against the bill? Don't see any members on the list.
You do.
I do? Representative Faust.
Real
he's not on the list, but he has his hand up. He's learned the Demmer trick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A real quick question. What is the urgency, or why is there such a need for a one-time funding? Where have you gotten your money in the past? Where are you going to get in the future? And why is it so important that we have this one-time thing?
Ms. Guerin.
We've gotten funding for the past several years from private sources, private individuals, and from corporations. We feel that it's necessary to expand this program faster than we can through private donations, and that this will be an avenue for us to do that so that all of the students in the Minneapolis and St. Paul Public Schools have an opportunity to engage in this program. We also feel that the one-time funding that we get here with the test data that we've been getting will allow us the time we need to go to corporations and foundations to get additional funding for the future.
Thank you. House File 1850 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Thank you very much, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I move House File 1798 for possible inclusion.
Representative Morrow moves House File 1798 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to keep this very quick. What I'm trying to do here is to address the concern of insufficient kindergarten space for schools that I want to do all day, every day kindergarten. What this bill would do would allow districts to apply to the commissioner under lease levy authority to add space to existing buildings. This is an approach we're currently doing in St. Peter, and I do mean literally as we speak. My fourth grader tells me that they've started digging near her classroom in order to add space for all day with a kindergarten purposes in St. Peter. I know Mankato's also followed this model. I'm just trying to make an option available to other districts in the state.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. That was nice and concise. Any questions? Any testimony for or against from the audience? Thank you. This is an option we may need to consider. House File 1798 will be laid over for possible inclusion. And members, we will reconvene in this room at 6 p.m. Meeting's adjourned.
I will call the meeting to order. We will come back out of recess.
But since I am a fiscal analyst, I'm going to share the committee I'm working
with. Oh, I'm too nice. I bet he says that all the committee he's working for. We know that.
Yeah.
Representative Bunn.
And Representative Bunn, we apologize. As you know, there are many, many committee meetings going on, so a lot of our members have checked in and then run off to other committees to check in. And then run off to other committees to check in. And what? Representative Demmer did that, and he's back. We did. We're glad you're back. let's see. Representative Bunn, we can continue to have our quorum from this morning, so I will move House File 1321 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Welcome, and
great.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here today to present testimony on House File 1321, the World Languages Bill. And as you know, that in general, I lean a little policy wonkish, but tonight in introduction, I'm going to speak from both my heart and my experience about these kinds of issues and why I'm championing this piece of legislation. A version of this bill was introduced in previous years, and also a version came to me at the beginning of this year. And I basically stepped up to do it because I have long experience with issues related to this, and when I heard some of the other proposals that were out here at the beginning of the session, I had some issues with some of them. I mentioned that to Representative Greiling, and she said, well, I have a bill for you that would take an approach that's dear to your heart. So that is why I'm here this evening. did many changes to the bill, and we've evolved over time. And in the last committee, education policy, we submitted a delete all at that time that altered the bill further to make it incorporating some of the responses we've gotten from members and other legislators. In terms of what's motivating behind this, like I said, I want to speak from my experience and my heart a bit on this, and why it's so important that we start early and often to move children in our state towards proficiency in world languages. I myself have been fortunate enough to both live and work overseas and to study abroad over my lifetime. And in doing so, you observe a number of things. I've lived and worked in both industrialized countries and developing countries. And what you notice, even in the most less developed countries in the world, is that in their urban areas, people learn a second language. Not always in rural areas, but in urban areas they do. And then in our industrial country competitors, everyone learns a second language. All walks of life, tradespeople, middle-class people, upper-class people, starting at some lower level of the K-6 span. Because of that, they have an exposure and opportunities that many of our students do not have. I also taught college economics during the 1990s, and over 60% of my students were from other countries. All of these students spoke at least two languages fluently, and oftentimes, most often, three or more languages quite well and could read in those languages well. Because of that, these students now work all over the world in all kinds of professions and are taking advantage of what the global economy has to offer. I've also hosted AFS and Rotary Exchange students in my home from a variety of countries. Again, in all these instances, whether it was a South American country or a Western European one, they were exposed to another language at early late ages and provided them opportunities our students don't have for extending languages to a higher level of proficiency. I also know that probably like many of you, I was exposed to languages for the first time at about age 14. And brain research shows us that the language sense of our brain has already been kind of pruned down by that point. And we don't learn second languages very well at that point. And for myself, I've never become very adept at that second language, even though I've taken it in high school, later in college a little bit, later after college a little bit. My daughter still tells me I'm terrible at foreign languages. So on the other hand, my own daughter was fortunate enough to go to an immersion program. And by sixth grade, was entirely fairly fluent and working in that other language. And by 16, is completely comfortable with it, even though she's in a regular school program now and has traveled and now is thinking about what third language she'll take in college. Having said these introductory remarks, I just want to say a couple things about the bill in terms of what it contains. The core element. The first core element is that it has a coordinator at the state level. We are one of many, most states already have this kind of position. We only have a part-time position working in this area in our state. We're behind. Secondly, the function of this coordinator and this bill, the elements of this bill, is to enhance and to support the diffusion of model programs of world language education for K through 12 throughout the state, putting most of the emphasis on K through 8. Secondly, the bill provides for pilot projects to enhance what schools are already doing and school districts are already doing, and also to develop new and better models for world language education in K through 12. At least half of these must be through K through 8. In addition, there are some elements to increase the flow of teachers through the pipeline in our state to be able to teach and enhance the capacity for world languages in our system. So there's some teacher training allocations, some teacher recruitment incentives, and some other features that will assist this teacher recruitment effort. I now would like to introduce my two testifiers, Jan Caddick, and I'll introduce who she is, and then we have a parent to speak as well. Thank you.
Okay. Who's going first?
Jan.
Okay. Please welcome, and please, again, welcome back, and please state your name for the record.
Good evening. My name is Janice Holter-Kiddock. I am the president of the Minnesota Council on the Teaching of Languages and Cultures. We are the professional organization of all world language educators, K-16 in Minnesota. Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to address you this evening. I'm going to focus on the pilot program aspect of this legislation and to address the benefits, why we need the pilot programs, and how everybody will benefit from them. We have a vision that all Minnesota graduates
will at some time in the future graduate with at least a minimal proficiency level in a language other than English. To realize that vision in the future, we need to tap into all of the resources that exist, and many are underutilized in the state of Minnesota, for teaching languages, teaching many languages, and many ways of teaching languages. We need to, one thing that many people do not know, that as soon as you learn one language, whatever language you may need to know or want to learn in the future is greatly facilitated by having already gone through the process of learning a language. Similarly, if you were to join the band, you learn one instrument. If you want to learn another instrument, you already know how music works. You have many skills for learning music, and so when you learn that second instrument, it's much easier. I grew up in South Minneapolis and studied Spanish through the Minneapolis Public School System. At that point in time, we had no idea to foresee into the future that Somali and Hmong would be major languages in my community. If I were still living and working in my community in whatever capacity, if I wanted to or needed to learn either of those languages, I could readily do so because I have a language skill background. What we do know about language proficiency are three principles: start early, start strong, and keep them long. Those are the three main principles for highly effective programs that get results with language proficiency. In recent years, our organization has had informational tables at the Minnesota School Boards Association and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. In talking with all of these people, everybody is saying the question, yes, we want our children to learn languages. I want my children, I want my grandchildren, I want every student in my district to have the opportunity to learn language. The question they all have and do not have the answer for is how. And that is the question that can be answered by the model programs. Whether you're in a large urban district, suburban district, or if you're in a remote geographical area of the state with K-12 all in one building, you need a model that shows you how you can offer this opportunity to your students. The language education then is not the same as the language education now. It's not just conjugating verbs and memorizing vocabulary. I visited a model program in Glastonbury, Connecticut a few years ago where they have had standard Spanish and Russian as part of their core elementary curriculum since 1954. And when I visited a seventh grade class, they weren't doing low-level thinking skills. They were doing higher-order thinking skills in Spanish. They were studying the content of the architectural details of a Gothic cathedral, with the teacher speaking totally in Spanish, doing the PowerPoint, and then later doing reading and activities in their groups totally in Spanish. When we look to expecting higher language proficiency from students at the secondary level, in our higher education levels, and in our citizenry, we need to look at the big picture of promoting an early start program. Pilot programs that model how an early start can result in language proficiency will give districts additional options, many options, for educating their students with the skills and knowledge that they will need to thrive in the decades to come.
Thank you, Ms. Kiddock. And I had the pleasure of being at their annual meeting when you were elected president. That was a very, very good day. And the next testifier, if you could say your name and give us your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Amy Double, and I'm a parent of two children that are currently in the Spanish Immersion Program in South Washington County in Woodbury, and it is an amazing program. My husband and I only speak English, and it's amazing how our first and second grader can have conversations with native Spanish speakers, and then they turn to us and start speaking, assuming that we'll be able to keep up with the conversation, and we can't. And what's so exciting about it is they love learning this second language. Additionally, they actually learn Mandarin Chinese 2 hours a week as well, and picking up that third language, like what was just mentioned, is so exciting to see that they can actually flip into a completely different language and learn that as well. And one of the things that I wanted to share with you is recently I went on a field trip with the Spanish Immersion first graders to the Minnesota Zoo, and it was Spanish Day. And what they did is they had students from Minnesota, mostly high school students, that were giving them presentations about zoo animals in Spanish. And the thing that I found most compelling was these students had memorized their presentations. So when these first and second graders were asking them questions, they oftentimes had to break into English because it was outside of what they had memorized for their presentation. But we did go to one booth that had fourth through sixth graders from a private school here in Minnesota, and those kids received about 2 hours of Spanish a week. They were actually able to have conversation with these first and second graders and answer back in Spanish and actually talk about what their presentation was in that language. And what I found fascinating by that is I took Spanish in high school and college, and I memorized what I needed to, and I cannot have a conversation with my children in Spanish at this point because they've learned it early. And in fact, they have a four-year-old brother, and he's picking up Spanish and Chinese, and he's not even in school yet. So I ask you to really think about this and make Minnesota ahead of the game, because all the other countries are doing it, and we just really need to get there. I also know as they're reading in English, they're much more in tune to language as a whole. So they're picking up different things in English that I think their friends that have only learned English kind of miss. So there's a lot of benefits to learning it early on, and you know, we're very fortunate that our kids are learning a second and third language, but every young student in Minnesota should have that opportunity with World Language. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Double. I don't see any questions right at the moment. Anybody in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Okay, well, House File 1321 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much. I can't speak any Spanish either, and I had 4 years of it. I went to college. I tested out of it because I could conjugate verbs very well, and it didn't do me a bit of good.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Representative Paulson. And for members of the audience, we're following the agenda, except we are doing my bill, House File 196, last. I always try to do my bills last, so I'm not... I know I have to be here, whether anybody else is or not. Representative Paulson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Do you have someone to move your bill, or should I move it? Yes. All right, I will move House File 1424 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Paulson.
Madam Chair, I know you have a busy agenda. I'll just start out by saying this legislation is a continuation of the legislation that we actually passed last year in session, establishing the Mandarin curriculum, the common curriculum that we use across the state. And the recommendations now before you actually come from the group of the commission or the task force of about 100 people that came together and spent a lot of their personal time, actually, Madam Chair, to come up with some recommendations on how to best position our students and our education system to develop further proficiencies in world language, and especially Mandarin, as we look to being able to compete in the global economy. And it includes offering grants for pilot programs for school districts, existing programs as well as new, and some teacher scholarships that I think would be very useful. And we've got little provisions in Representative Bunn's bill that was mentioned as well. And we have some of the folks here that are willing to testify, Madam Chair, and we'll keep it brief. And I would like to just mention that these are actual practitioners that participated in this process. So they put a lot of time and effort in it, and I think that's some very meaningful testimony.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to talk tonight. At first, I would like to introduce a few people that were involved in the program.
Mr. Bittman, obviously I know who you are, but could you say your name for the tape, please?
Yes,
and
ma'am.
Your title.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Bittman. I'm the Director of License for the Department of Education and the facilitator of the Mandarin Project. I would like to introduce the individuals who are really responsible for doing the work with the approximately 100 individuals in the project, which I won't introduce all. At my right is Margaret Wong, who's an expert Chinese language teacher who was involved with the curriculum portion. Mm-hmm. To my left, Ms. Cindy Moeller, who's the chair of the board at Yinghua Academy, our first immersion school here in Minnesota. Ursula Lenz, who's the coordinator of the Minnesota Language Proficiency Assessments, worked for Carlin University and the coordinator of the Quality Teaching Network Academic Standards and High School Improvement at MDE. Dr. Martha Bigelow, who is also involved with Margaret for the curriculum portion, who's the assistant professor at the Second Languages and Cultures Program in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Minnesota, and Dr. Michael Miller, who's the dean of the College of Education at Minnesota State. we too are supportive of Representative Bunn's bill and many of the portions, and so we won't comment on much of what they did, other to say that we also feel the importance of beginning language early and often and providing as many opportunities for children as we can. Currently in Minnesota, only 19% of Minnesota students, K-12, take foreign language, and we feel that in order to be competitive globally and to provide opportunities for students, that we need to do something with foreign languages. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Margaret Wong for some brief comments about her expertise and her insight.
Welcome, Ms. Wong. If you could restate your name for the tape.
My name is Margaret Wong. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity. Mm-hmm. I will begin my remarks with an apology because I was told that I was to talk about myself. And for a very, very long life, I have to do it in 2 minutes.
Okay. We apologize for that.
Madam Chair, that was my direction.
Thank you, Dr. Bittman.
I've been a Chinese language teacher for over 30 years in both public and private schools in Minnesota. And I was very fortunate to have had a visionary superintendent in the person of Dr. John Davis, who asked me to teach Chinese at Minneapolis Central High School right after Nixon, President Nixon, went to China in 1972. And I've spent all my life both learning and teaching languages. I taught French and Spanish and ESL, but it was teaching Chinese that became my true calling, because after all, Chinese is my native language, and through language I've been able to introduce other aspects of China to my students, its long history, its rich culture, the arts, philosophy, and even cuisine. More than 50-some years ago, my family escaped communist China, narrowly. My father was a general in the defeated nationalist army. We first escaped to Hong Kong and later to Brazil. And I remember the night we were leaving Hong Kong. My father gathered the 8 children, all of us under the age of 15, to tell us we were leaving our country forever, and that we must never forget our mother tongue, but we must now begin to learn new languages and new cultures. Because we knew that it would be a long time before we would ever be able to return. And in fact, it was more than 27 years later that I led the first American high school youth group to China. That was in 1976. And since then, I've continued teaching Chinese and have established many programs of Chinese in Minnesota and nationwide. Let me just very briefly tell you why learning Chinese is important, and learning Chinese early is very important, because Chinese is a language very different from English. And research tells us that, of course, the earlier you learn a language, the better. But it also says that learning Mandarin, which is so different from Western languages, taxes your brain twice as much, because speaking the tonal language uses one part of the brain, but learning those beautiful Chinese characters uses the other part. And so when you exercise the brain of a child early, they are going to become twice as smart when they get older. Another reason is, of course, you all know China is the largest, most populous nation on earth, and it's becoming a very large consumer nation that needs things from the United States. Trade between our two countries is now second to Canada. And I remember when I was teaching at Central High School, Dr. Ernest Boyer came to visit my class and told me that I was teaching a fourth of American students in the United States. That was in the 80s. But in the last 5 years, and I was only teaching 75 students, so there were only about 300 students studying Chinese nationwide. But in the last 5 years, enrollment has increased tremendously, and I would say that now there are over 50,000 college students studying Chinese, 30,000 K-12 students, and well over 100,000 heritage learners. Altogether, that makes 180,000, and that is still a very small number compared to the 50 million Chinese learning English. We'll never catch up, just by sheer numbers, but I know that it is time for us to really step up and Minnesota should be the leader in the nation. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. You used your 2 minutes well. Ms. Moeller, if you could please state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Cindy Moeller, and I'm the chair of the board of Yinghua Academy. So good evening, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. I'm here to give you just a quick snapshot of Yinghua Academy and of the interest that many parents have in programs like ours. Yinghua Academy is the first Chinese immersion school in the Midwest, and we are the first Chinese immersion charter school anywhere in the United States. We just opened this past fall. We're located on Pierce Butler Route here in St. Paul. It's only about 10 minutes from here. We have 88 students in kindergarten through third grade. Next year we'll add fourth grade and then additional grades in the subsequent years. Nearly half of our students are kindergartners, and our kindergarten is a full-day kindergarten. We already have 59 applications for next year's kindergarten. Our students in kindergarten and first grade are fully immersed in Mandarin Chinese all day, every day. They're learning all academic subjects in Chinese. In fact, as far as our kindergartners and first graders know, their teachers speak only Chinese. Every day begins with an all-school morning meeting that includes things like singing Chinese songs and reading stories in Chinese and in English. Our staff have created a curriculum map based on the core knowledge sequence and the Minnesota standards, and they are creating from scratch many of the materials that we use. Both our current parents and future parents are very enthusiastic about Yinghua Academy. Our current parents have told us so many times how much they appreciate having this opportunity for their children and how amazed they are by how much their children have already learned this year. We are also getting considerable interest from parents of future Yinghua students. We've had parents with babies and toddlers come to our open houses because they are already starting to plan for their children's education. Many have asked if we have a waiting list, which of course we do not, since we are a charter public school. Just this past Sunday, I got an email from a mom that reads in part as follows. Her daughter's going to start school in a year from this fall. She says, "I'm already stressed because I so want her in this program. I think it is so phenomenal to have this kind of school available to our daughters, and I almost just can't bear the thought that this opportunity could slip by us." If you would ever like to visit Yinghua Academy, I would like to encourage you to contact me. We would be happy to give you a little tour, show you what's going on. And I hope that you will support the development of programs like ours and other programs that give kids the opportunity to develop real capability in a language, at least one language, in addition to English. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Or Dr. Miller, I should say.
I'm Mike. Thanks. My name is Mike Miller. I'm Dean of the College of Education at Minnesota State Mankato. And I just want to speak briefly as well. Thank you very much for that opportunity. I was co-chair of Group 3, which is the Legislative Recommendations Committee at the culmination of this project. I served with Dr. D. Tadek, who's at the University of Minnesota. It was a broad, inclusive opportunity to talk about some of these issues, and I learned a great deal while doing so. It seems to me supporting foreign language is important on three different reasons. First, intercultural competence rationale. As citizens of the world, we should be doing this. Certainly, the economic competitiveness is an important rationale. And then the ancillary learning, the other kinds of learning that are supported by language learning is, I was very impressed with the research. Students do better in math and science, a whole variety of other areas if learning another language. So there's many, many reasons why this is the right thing to do at this particular point in time. I want to comment briefly that in order to carry this off, we're going to need at least five times as many foreign language teachers over the next few years, and so many teacher preparation institutions are doing our best to send people abroad and get on the mark in terms of planning programs. And so certainly Kathy Johnson from St. Cloud State, Mankato, University of Minnesota, and others are looking after this as diligently as we can, seeking grants and donations to support the development, but we simply don't have the startup money to be able to do this particularly well. So I'm hopeful that in one committee or another we can find ways to support at least part of the money to bring up the preparation programs that we'll need in order to have the teachers here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lenz.
Or no, I'm sorry. I was looking at the list. Oh, you are going to. Maybe I should let Dr. Bittner say who's next. Is that who's next? I'm just looking at my list.
I think the Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we are here to answer questions,
okay,
if there are any.
Okay, very good. Well, there are. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thought I was going to have a whole lot of questions, but Representative Paulson and I have gotten into it a couple of times, but I see he's got a new engrossment here, and I like it a lot better. So I want to thank you for your changes. And Representative Bond, likewise, neither one of you are addressing the elective or the standard, so I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Heidgerken. Things always...
Yep.
Keep rolling along here, don't they?
Yep.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Miller, it's good to see you. Dr. Miller and I were colleagues at one point at Gustavus, so maybe I'll direct this question to Dr. Miller.
It'll probably be a hard one, too.
Dr. Miller, I'm fully supportive of the idea. The one question I have is for the grants for teacher licensure programs such as at Gustavus. My understanding from reading the bill is it looks like Gustavus would not be eligible to receive a grant for teacher licensure preparation in Mandarin Chinese. I was wondering if that was a decision of the committee, and if so, if I could understand the reason why private institutions couldn't participate.
Dr. Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morrow. The committee did not specify what kinds of institutions would or would not be eligible for those kinds of grants. We tried to have conversations about what would be reasonable given short state budgets, enough money to get people interested and into the game without necessarily looking for full funding. So I can't speak to that.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up, then maybe Representative Paulson, maybe the question is better for you. Would you be open to having private institutions also being eligible for grants under the same provisions?
Representative Paulson.
And actually, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Morrow. The conversations that we've had, my understanding is we were allowing that availability for everybody, and maybe it's not drafted appropriately, but that is the discussion that we've had in the past, so, and maybe I'm saying that.
Representative Paulson, that was originally my reading as
yeah.
well. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
And I asked Mr. Strom, maybe I'll let Mr. Strom jump into the conversation as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Paulson and Morrow, I'm coming into this halfway through. My understanding is the sums were appropriated to Minsky, and I guess I was not aware if the discussion there was whether Minsky was going to make grants beyond its system or not.
Dr. Bittman.
Madam Chair, Representative, that language was meant to be amended, and I have not seen the most recent addition that was just done as of yesterday, I believe, but our intention on the committee is to include all those colleges and make those opportunities available to everyone.
Representative Morrow is happy. And no other questions on the list, so any closing comment, Representative Paulson?
No, again, we just appreciate the chair and the committee's time, and I think that it is safe to say that there is a lot of interest out there for Mandarin in particular. Mm-hmm. I know that some school districts, St. Cloud, I know Kathy Johnson would be really excited to run down here and say what's going on in St. Cloud, and there are other communities that are looking at immersion programs, and I think there is going to be a high demand, and the challenge is for us to provide some resources to help them get up and running.
Thank you very much, Representative Paulson and testifiers.
Thank you.
This committee, I think, is now that we've got it, got Representative Heidgerken satisfied, I think we're very interested in world language. Representative Rothwell.
Madam Chair, it's not my intention to move that bill this evening. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. That'll save us a little bit of time. Okay, and now we have Representative Slawik and Representative Anzel, both of whom we told not to come here till around 7:15, so we'll just talk amongst yourselves. We'll take a slight recess. No, because it's... Don't go too far, because it'll probably be like 5 minutes.
And when we're on the work group conference, we would start at 8.
As soon as they find them.
5 minute recess. Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah.
You're not going to ever do it, or do it tonight? Probably not.
5 minute recess.
Holy cow, what is this world coming to?
Your education should fail. Yeah.
I'm going to go up to the other committee for 5 minutes. If you got Randy Netflix killing.
I would if we had money, because I think you're right. It sounds like it.
The nice thing is, you know, all year you find a place to use the money, but all the important thing is there is a lot of money.
It's like when
Bailey and Brady are in
art. Theater.
Hello, I'm Cheryl.
In fact, Bailey's at MSU. A musical at 60, and both my daughters are in it. My wife started in theater, and he's been doing it.
Are you sure you're going to stay, or are you going to come? No, I'm going to
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
Oh, Mindy, I'll
thank you very much. We needed to find more. We needed to get more.
I think there's a little bit over there.
Yep.
You're back.
We're good to go.
We're back out of recess. Representative Slawick, I will move House File 1196 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm sorry about that. I was chairing another committee and didn't realize the bill was up. So I very much appreciate you hearing this bill, first of all. This is a bill that has been around for several years, and we've been trying to pass this. This is a very good bill and a kind of an inexpensive bill that I hope you all will vote for. What this does is there are kids that have their home district, obviously, where they live, and they have child care in a different district. So if you take it like that, I'm in North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, but say my child gets daycare in St. Paul. Well, if the child, I know you have a child, my son's in special ed, so if your child is in
the daycare in St. Paul, but then needs to go to his special ed services, say for the afternoon program, what we want to make sure is the home district is paying for those services. Because normally they need to go back to the home district to get their services, but transportation is such a big issue, it's often much easier for kids to get them in the other district. And this is something that's done at the K-12 level, but we're just bringing it down to the pre-K level. And so I'd like my testifier, Darren Kermes from New Ulm, right?
New Prague.
New Prague. I should know this by now. Testified a few times together.
News anyway.
But he can tell you more specifics about why this is a big issue, but you could do a quick fix, we think, and just change the law and make it a lot easier for our families.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Kermes. If you could restate your name for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Darren Kermes. I'm the Director of Special Services for New Prague Area Schools. I'm also the Director of the Special Education for MRFSEC, which is the cooperative that covers Prior Lake, Shakopee, Belle Plaine, Jordan, Montgomery, Lonsdale. I'm here today on behalf of MACE, the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, who are supporting this bill and are championing this bill. We believe that this is an important bill and an important piece of legislation that covers approximately 100 students with disabilities prior to kindergarten entrance. It really, what it does is takes a department standard that applies K-12 and simply extends it down to the birth to five kids with disabilities. A couple of key points. This does not add any new students. These are all kids, by definition, who have already been determined eligible for special education. The current status is that many districts already do this, provide services, as Representative Sawick described, but some don't. And so you have situations where child care is difficult to find in the first place, and if you couple that with a student with a disability seeking child care, it becomes even more difficult. And once the parent finally finds that child care, if it happens to be outside their resident district, maybe it's because they want it closer to their work, or maybe it's because that's where they found the good child care program, what this bill would do is say that the district where that child care is located provides special ed services and simply bills back to the resident district for the cost of those services. This is exactly what happens for kids in grades K-12. It's been the standard for several years. It works very well in K-12, and we simply would love to see it extended down to preschool kids, because right now we do have, and our best guess that we have in informal surveys is about 100 kids every year that go without services that they are entitled to and that help prepare them for kindergarten.
Okay, don't see anyone on the list. Any testimony for or against from the audience? Okay, any comment from the department, as long as we have? She's not listening. She's busy. Okay, well, Rep. McFarland.
Yes. Madam Chair, I'm wondering, is there any difference in the cost of providing the service between district to district? I mean, might it cost more for them to go to another district and the home district would have to incur that cost?
Mr. Hermes.
Yes.
Madam Chair. We're not doing well with your name today.
The Hermes from New Ulm for all I care today, as long as you're happy with the bill.
Darren Dennison.
Madam Chair, Representative. Mm-hmm. In theory, there shouldn't. It's an entitled service. And I will say that districts are sometimes different in the way they create programs and do things. So there might be a slightly different flavor, but that's kind of the uniqueness of the way we all as directors provide services in our district. But the services that they're entitled to should be the same. It might just be a slightly different model district to district. So in one case, the model might be slightly more expensive, and in some place else, it might be slightly less. But the fact that this would exist does not increase the standard or increase the cost for them.
Thank you very much. House Bill 1196 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay. We'll just wait about a couple. I know Ms. Patrick went to find Representative Anzels, and if we can't find him in a couple minutes, why, then we'll do my bill. But any word on Representative Anzels?
Did the patient know which committee to look for him?
Shannon was looking for him. What committee is he entering?
I can. He has a bill in public safety, I believe.
And public safety is?
I can go. I can go up.
Okay, great.
Or he's either in 500 north or south.
Hang on 2 seconds, Megan, I can tell you.
He's looking for the exact room.
I mean, wrong committee. So he's at 500. It's either north or okay. south. Even if we give you the right room, I may have the wrong committee. Okay. He's 500. Yeah, and there's someone in front of the north, and I wrote it down. He's in one of the...
Sure enough. It's 31.
Yes.
We should add more tonight. We didn't have to do it till tomorrow.
Yes, that product.
I know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Here I am.
Too late now.
Too late now.
How do we know?
Yeah, no, we actually only have 196 and 1423.
So, okay. 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 Thank you.
Liz, I'm sure we're going to be done by now, but it's 8:50. I look at it. I keep telling it, right? Remind me at 8:50. Who is going to hear?
I don't actually care about them. They were out for,
On the last bill. Well,
No, Megan,
Representative Anzel is here. To be continued. Okay, we'll continue on with the meeting. Representative Anzel, you are on the committee, so you can move your own bill.
Thank you.
I see now you. It is worth your trip here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I apologize for any inconvenience I may have caused the committee, but I would move House File 1423 for possible inclusion.
Representative Anzel moves House File 1423 for possible inclusion. You can see everybody's everywhere tonight, so we're not giving any authors too much trouble tonight.
Madam Chair and members, this is the a bill that would propose to affect only one school district in the state of Minnesota. That would be Independent School District 361 in International Falls, Minnesota. And it would expand the lease levy authorization to include payments of principal and interest for this particular school district for personal property that could be acquired under an installment contract or a lease arrangement. And with that, I would ask school superintendent Don Langan to provide the committee with some additional information.
He's not a representative tonight.
No.
Superintendent Langan, welcome back.
Yes, I'm Don Langan, Superintendent, ISD 361 International Falls. The current statute, 126C40, the lease levy statute, has provisions for leasing real properties, bricks and mortar, if you will. And it also has a Subdivision 6, which provides that those revenues can be used by deseg districts or districts with desegregation obligation with commissioner approval to use those dollars for real or personal property, i.e. equipment. The concerns that I face, and perhaps several other districts, and I'm very sensitive to the fact that there could be 300 Me Toos with this bill, is that in International Falls, Minnesota, we are certainly not looking to lease any property for instructional purposes. We've gone from about 435,000 square feet of instructional space down to about 230,000 square feet. So instructional space utilization under current statute and revenue available is something that we can't use. The other thing that is facing us is the tremendous decline in student enrollment that we've seen in International Falls. 1976, I believe, we graduated 300 students. I'll graduate 104 in 2007. So we've lost two-thirds of our students. We've closed half of our space. And that which remains is in dire need of upgrading, but particularly I'm concerned with the instructional equipment for our kids. I think that any real superintendent can come down and whine about the students they've lost. I'll tell you right now, I got the 1,240 best kids in the state of Minnesota, so I'm here to brag about my kids, not the other way around. With the single handout, for those of you who really didn't know where International Falls was, I believe you have a map.
I can assure you, Superintendent Langan, this committee knows where we are.
Oh, good. Yes, we all know here in the legislature where International
Falls. And my comments will be for the audience behind me then.
Okay.
One of the problems that a lot of rural schools have, and ours is certainly no exception, is in the lack of ability to create any economies of scale. For example, my wood shop fellow comes down and says, Donna, we really need a surface planer. In other words, construction program. That planer costs $30,000. We build a house a year and have for 28 years up there. For a district such as myself, that piece of equipment is going to be for a very limited number of kids, and I have no opportunity to amortize that cost out with, say, neighboring schools in a collaborative model. My nearest district where such a collaborative partner could be found would probably, even though I didn't draw the arrow, could have been Baudette, which is about 70 miles school to school. But in most cases, I'm 98 miles from Virginia, 99 to Hibbing, 120 to Grand Rapids, and 111 to Bemidji. So our concern is that with the $73 a year that I get in equipment money, and the last biology book I bought was $75, we have very little available revenue to provide the instructional equipment for our kids. What is happening is I'm taking it out of general fund, unreserved, undesignated, just like everybody else. So in looking at the lease levy, the $100 pupil unit, which in my case would generate about a maximum with board authority at $135,000, it would provide us an opportunity to access revenues for improvement of facilities and equipment in the same manner as other districts in the state. Thank you very much, Madam.
Thank you, Superintendent Langan. Any questions? Any testimony from the audience? Okay. House File 1423 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Manzels, I should have given you a last word. Do you have one?
No last word.
Okay.
Everything is fine.
All right. That sounds good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you very much. Okay,
Keep the Mountain Dew away from me. You said to keep a lid on it?
No.
6 months.
Do we need two?
Yeah.
I'll sit over here then.
Rose O'Grady, would you like to move your bill to be passed and re-refer to the Education Finance Division with further recommendation for referral to the Housing Policy and Finance and Public Health Finance Division?
Mr. Chair, I would. I would move House File 196 and so forth.
Thank you, Representative Greiling, and so forth. Please, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we're well aware that we are away from all of you and your trips home or to the other committees that you should be in, but there has been a heavy amount of traffic on email and other places over this bill, and some of it has said that there has not been a full hearing. So you're going to have to suffer through a full hearing, even though I suspect that we're talking to the choir here, so that you can help report to those who are saying that there has been a full hearing. This bill is on a small part of House File 196, and it's the Article 2, Section 5. I think it's just a few lines on the Columbia teen screen. The rest of it, the jurisdiction for this bill is in other committees. Excuse me, Article 5. It's on Article 2, Section 5 on page 11, and it's a program for grants for either public schools, family service collaboratives, or children's mental health collaboratives for some pilots for the Columbia Teen Screen. Not pilots, just grants to implement the program. And the Columbia Teen Screen is a well-researched suicide prevention screening program that focuses on depression, anxiety, and substance abuse. And these are very treatable conditions in our youth. And this is something that has been done in some of our school districts to great success. And I will, with that, turn it over to Sue Abderholden, who's the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, who's here with her daughter, Eva.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Sue Abderholden, executive director of NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI is a grassroots organization that provides education, support, and advocacy to children and adults with mental illness and their families. Nearly all of our board members and staff either have a mental illness or have a family member with a mental illness. And I'm here to speak in favor of the provision of this bill that would fund the Teen Screen program in Minnesota. In its July 2003 final report, President Bush's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health stated that early detection of mental illness was a cornerstone of a transformed mental health system. The commission cited the Columbia University's Teen Screen program as a model for early intervention. Teen Screen, which has been implemented in 460 communities in 42 states nationwide, is a mental health and suicide risk screening program for young people. The screen focuses on depression, mood disorders, substance abuse, and suicide. This is not a screening for ADHD. Frankly, we already know who those kids are. Its goal is to ensure that every parent is offered the opportunity to have their teenager receive a voluntary mental health checkup. The way that it works is that parents are sent home a permission slip. Young people who consent and whose parents consent then fill out the questionnaire. If a teen scores high, he or she is interviewed to determine if the teenager may be at risk for depression, suicide, or other mental health problems. Parents of youth found to be at possible risk are notified so that they can support their child and, if they choose, get help with identifying and connecting to local services where they can obtain a complete evaluation by a qualified professional. Treatment decisions, if any, are always left to the parents and guardians. I want to make it very clear that this is a voluntary program for school districts and for parents. Teen Screen requires active consent. Information that you received that states that Teen Screen uses passive consent was taken from a 2004 document that is no longer used. If you look at their 2006 documents, which can be found on their website, it clearly states that sites are required to obtain written active consent from parents or legal guardians for the screening of students. NAMI believes strongly in parental consent and involvement.
100% of the sites now require and use active parental consent. TeenScreen is effective, and there is research behind it. It does not have a high rate of false positives. It is only 19% compared to the false positive rate for the Pap test, which is 24%. In your packet, you have an explanation of how this data has been misinterpreted. The opposition also brings up the United States Preventive Services Task Force article as concluding that screening is not effective. This is a misunderstanding of the article. While it is accurate that this independent panel of experts reviewed screenings for adults in primary care settings, it is inaccurate to use this article in reference to TeenScreen. This task force did not look at the effectiveness of screening in schools or for teenagers. In fact, the article states that the existing literature suggests that screening tests perform reasonably well in adolescents and that treatments are effective, and that further study is warranted. Groups that oppose TeenScreen have described mental health screening as, I quote, a new liberal tool for child control. They do not believe that mental illness is a chemical imbalance of the brain and continue to put forth that these are not real illnesses. This isn't a fight about parental permission or control. It's a fight over whether these are real illnesses of the brain. Well, I'm here to tell you that these are real illnesses, and they affect everyone, regardless of race, income level, religion, even political party. There are many Republican and Democratic members of the Minnesota legislature who have a family member with a mental illness. To support or oppose TeenScreen should not be a party line vote. U.S. Senators Domenici and Wellstone couldn't have been farther apart on issues, but on one thing they agreed, that mental illnesses are real and children and adults should be able to access treatment like they would for any other illness. You heard earlier today from school counselors who see students who are suicidal. Suicide is the second or third leading cause of death of young people, depending on how you break out the ages, under the age of 20. In 2005, 55 young people in Minnesota under the age of 20 took their own lives. 11 were under the age of 15. Just picking a few counties, there were 7 each in Hennepin and Scott, 5 in Beltrami and Ramsey County, 3 in Stearns, 2 each in Washington, Dakota, Anoka, Maurer, and Olmsted. Too many children have faced overwhelming despair. Surely there is more that we can do to save their lives. Many parents, including myself, have struggled with discerning what is typical teenage behavior and what is behavior I should be concerned about. Many of us would welcome the opportunity to get more information about our teenagers. Many of us wish our children had been identified earlier to avoid medications or to have saved their child's life. I urge you to support this bill.
Ms. Abderhold, if you'd state your name as well before you
start. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Eva Abderhold and Keller. When my mom was telling me about the TeenScreen bill, I thought it made perfect sense. And when I heard that there are people who oppose this bill, I was flabbergasted. Why wouldn't you want to help catch depression in teens during the earlier stages? As a teenager who suffered from depression, I knew that I wanted to share my story and show my support for this bill. In 8th grade, I was having many problems with school. Even though I had always been in the gifted and talented program, I was struggling with my classes. My friendships had been strong for many years, and suddenly I didn't seem to care about them anymore. After a while, I couldn't take it anymore and attempted suicide. I was lucky enough to have a very strong support system. My family, friends, and most of my teachers cared very much for me, and I was seeing a therapist. Today, I'm doing great, and I'm a senior at Southwest High School. I'm an Ivy Diploma candidate, and I'm hearing back from music schools and have great friends. I'm even on my student council's exec board. Looking at me today, you would never know that I spent over a year feeling incredibly depressed and horrible about myself. I just wish that when I was 14, there was something like TeenScreen, which would have caught my signs of depression at a much earlier stage, before it was possibly too late. I hope that you will support this bill. Depression in teenagers is a huge problem. There are many teenagers going through more than what people consider to be the teenage blues. If this bill is passed, so many teenagers will benefit from it. Many teenagers don't have the support system that I did and are suffering needlessly every day from depression. I hope you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Like they said, Mr. Chair, we're having a regular hearing. No one can say this pleasant.
Thank you. If you would also please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Ayers, and I'm a policy advocate with Family and Children's Service. We're a private nonprofit social service agency based primarily in the metro area.
I'm here also to speak in support of this provision of the big bill. And I would like to hit on just a couple things that Ms. Apter Holden did not hit on regarding some of the concerns with the Teen Screen program that many of you have probably heard through emails or letters. First is privacy, and this is a concern for parents regardless of where they are on the political spectrum. People want their kids' stuff private. The Teen Screen is private. Teachers are not involved in it. They do not perform the screening. They do not see the results. The results do not go into the kids' file. The program is administered by a coordinator who they either hire in or contract with. That is the only person that sees the results and performs the screening. Secondly, I'd just like to address the concern that comes with this and other screening bills, that if you screen children, you're immediately going to medicate children. There is nothing further from the truth. Screening children is no different in mental health than it is in physical health. It's very much just like a thermometer. When you go to the doctor because you have a temperature, the thermometer tells you you have a temperature. It doesn't tell you if you have the flu or any other disease. And if your temperature stays high, you go to the doctor and they do further tests and studies to figure out what you have and how to treat it. As mental health screening is no different. It takes the mental health temperature of the kid or adult, in this case the kid, and if the temperature is high, they are referred on if they want to see somebody else to see what the problem is or if there really is a problem. That's all screening does. It does not lead to medication. Often, if we work with early intervention and prevention techniques like mental health screening, we can avoid ever going down the path of medications. Not necessarily in every single case, but in more cases than not, particularly with children, we don't have to get to the medication piece. We can treat things early and much less restrictively and let the kid get back onto track and on with their lives and with their families. Finally, the other thing to remember with this, because it is done in the schools for the most part, the Minnesota state law is already clearly stated, and I'll just have to kind of read the quote. I don't have it memorized. Actually, I don't have the quote. But schools cannot prohibit a student's participation in school or school activities based on a parent's refusal to have that kid take medications, participate in a mental health screening, or participate in any other kind, or take psychotropic drugs. So regardless of what the parent and the child and the family decide with this, the kid, the teacher, or the school cannot say you can't participate. That's been a concern in the past. I think it's been clarified. This law was passed not too many years ago, but I just wanted to lay that out there, that kids are not going to be forced by the school system to participate in any of this. And I'll be willing to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Harris. I think we'll turn to the this final testifier first, and then we'll turn to see if there are questions, and then we'll turn to, we have other testifiers as well.
Mr. Chairman and city members, I have also a handout from one of my students that couldn't be here. She chose to be at her high school's basketball tournament, so she's submitting something in writing. My name is Eva Newbeck. I am a school social worker at South High School in Minneapolis. South has a population of about 1,800 students. I work with students who have a wide range of academic abilities, are from diverse backgrounds, male and female immigrants, and Native students. My work days are full of accepting referrals from students themselves, parents, teachers, and concerned students for reasons that present as mental illness. Mind you, I am not a clinician. If I were, I could not handle the volume of referrals who need screening, diagnosis, and treatment. Based on the referrals I receive and send, I can tell you that mental illness in teens is very present, at least in my high school, and I don't think we are abnormal. I see ADD and ADHD, depression, anxiety, chemical dependency, borderline personality disorders, bipolar, eating disorders, and ODC, OCD, and they're very common diagnoses that I see in children. I've been forced to make mental illness and mental health the cornerstone of my work as a school social work. Word spreads quickly among parents once they know a student and his or her family has been helped. Even before the school year begins, I often get phone calls from parents wanting me to be aware of their kids' needs. I work with students and their parents to get the appropriate health care. I cannot do it alone. They can't do it alone. I know how urgent the requests for help are. Therefore, I have collaborated with various providers to have services available at South High School. There are 20 students on any given week who see a therapist at South High School. Kids have already been diagnosed
or in the mental health care system. In addition, there's a school-based clinic through Hennepin County where more students are seen, again with parental consent. There are countless other families privately who manage their students' needs. In recent months, three of my students have been in day treatment, four in chemical dependency treatment with dual diagnoses, and countless others who are involved in the court system where family mental illness has been a contributing factor. And now to teen screen. I can assure you that not every high school has a social worker like me, but even for me, there's an excess of work to be done that just doesn't get done. Even every high school needs a teen screen opportunity as a safety net for students in need, hopefully before the crises occur. I have success stories of those whose times of crisis passed as a normal part of growing up. I also have success stories of students who have been able to graduate because they received help. Screening helps differentiate between the normal perils of growing up and the significant signs suggesting the abnormal. A little nudging by a peer to get a quick teen screen could go a long way towards enacting appropriate interventions and support. I work with a student group, the SRC's Silver Ribbon Campaign, and that is the testimony that you've been handed, where the students learn about mental illness and educate other students and staff. Because of their stigma-busting work, people at South are more aware of students in need. Students are not seen as lazy or slackers right off the bat by teachers. They're not considered not appropriate for honors chemistry if they need extended time on a test due to their anxiety. Factual information has helped everyone at South and has not, as some would argue, created suicidal students just because they learned about depression. Please support my work and the work of other frontline staff and our responsibility to provide the tools for screening mental illness in teens. Students with mental illness grow into adults with mental illnesses. The sooner anyone is able to manage their illness, the more able they will be to thrive in and contribute to our society. Thank you for the support of this bill.
Thank you for testimony.
Mr. Chairman, and
please state your name.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Sarah Brown. I graduated from Minneapolis South High School in 2005, and I'm now a sophomore attending Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I'm here on behalf of the Silver Ribbon Campaign, which is a group my friend Erica Severson and I founded in 2003. The group's main purpose is to raise awareness, eliminate the stigma, and give support to those students in our high school who either suffer from a mental illness or have family members who suffer from a mental illness. On the back of my shirt, there's the statistic, 1 in 5 families are affected by a mental illness. One of the reasons I decided to found the Silver Ribbon Campaign was in memory of my cousin Tim, who committed suicide in 2002. He was first diagnosed when he was admitted to a hospital at the age of 19 after a suicide attempt. He suffered from manic depression. He graduated from high school in 1986 and had never previously been diagnosed. It's well known that if diagnosed and treated, mental illnesses can be managed, and those suffering from the illness can live relatively normal lives. It is even easier to manage a mental illness when it is caught and treated early on. The teen screen in high schools is extremely important because it is known the characteristics of mental illnesses begin being displayed in a person in their teenage years. There were so many of my peers that I myself could have guessed suffered from anxiety, depression, or bipolar, but were never diagnosed or had never sought treatment. The stigma surrounding mental illnesses, not only in high schools, but everywhere, is gigantic. Nobody wants to be thought of as a freak or disabled. Suicide is the second to third leading cause of death among young people that fall within my age bracket. Students and parents need to know how to recognize the signs of mental illnesses and need an easy way to check to see if their kids may suffer from a mental illness. I think the teen screen in high schools is a necessary tool. It will make people like our advisor, social worker Eva Newbeck, be able to do their job more effectively and really assess how at risk a student may be in order to get them the proper help or medication needed. It also gets parents involved in their children's health. I've lost my cousin to a mental illness. I would hate to lose or have any of my peers suffer from a mental illness that is treatable that went undiagnosed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Grayling, do you have other testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes the testifiers. And I think that last testifier came from after a group of students visited Representative Walker. Is that right? Are you one of the... Oh, you're the group that was with. Anyway, Representative Walker contributed some of our testifiers tonight. So, Mr. Chair and members, that concludes our formal presentation, but I do know there's at least one testifier against the bill.
That's right. Representative Brown, I think we're first going to ask if committee members have questions for any of your testifiers first. Representative Swales.
Not so much a question, but I am a high school English teacher, and I just want to share a little story. It will be brief. A year ago, I had a wonderful student. I teach AP English, and I had him as a sophomore in honors English, and at that time, he was an engaging young man, just charming, fun, delightful. He was an avid reader, very interested in politics. He had strong opinions, but just a delightful young man. A year ago, he took his life, and it was a very devastating thing for me as a teacher who was incredibly close to him, and it was devastating to our student body. In talking with his parents and his family about it, they began to see that there were signs that he was depressed, that he was carrying this weight around with him. It would show up in his writings and things he began to read. And it was a very traumatic and painful loss for his parents. And there's a lot of second guessing now, or looking back, wishing with hindsight that they had acted in a more proactive manner, but not really wanting to think that something is wrong with your child. I, over the course of the years, have had, unfortunately, I can say the word, many students who have committed suicide. Either in the year that they have been in my class or in years after having been in my class and I have become acquainted with them. All I can say is that this is a serious issue. It is not a political issue. This affects every family. It affects every community. And I do welcome the opportunity to discuss it. I think it's time for us to stop putting a stigma on the notion that mental illness is not something that we should be addressing. I think our young people are incredibly vulnerable, and this is a good discussion of this issue, and I'm very happy that we're having it.
Thank you, Representative Swales.
Representative Swales, maybe your high school will apply for one of these grants.
Oh. Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. Madam Chair, I'm sorry I wasn't here for the full testimony, but mental health is my past employment. I did mental health with the Latino community, an organization called La Familia Guidance Center, which was the only Latino mental health agency in the state. And I mean the state is a clinic. We work with young women and men that from the ages of 7 on up to a teenage group. And well, we also worked on a wraparound. But I had the opportunity of working with these kids that were given to us by the courts because they were acting out and some of the issues that they were experiencing in their homes. And there was a lot of misdiagnosed kids that were we had to work with. As you recall, when we went to the hearing on the north side of Minneapolis over at the Gary Southwick Urban League, when we all went over there, some of the testimony that Dr. I don't recall his name.
Dr. Dyko.
Dr. Dyko. If you remember that conversation and the mental issues, things that came up and how these children are being diagnosed, and he's working with these kids every single day. And so, again, I'm glad to hear that we're having this conversation. One that, again, worked in a Latino and working with other groups. They weren't just necessarily Latino youth. They were African Americans, Asians that we worked with in that population. So I am really glad that we're having this conversation. Diagnosed in our community, especially the Latino community, is now just coming out. And we have to be very careful in how we diagnose people different, especially people of color. They're too often diagnosed and moved around and not getting the right treatment. And the first start of doing this is working within families, working with those kids that you may think they have problems. So again, I appreciate the conversation. I wish I was here earlier, but I had some bills that I had to pass too. So thanks again for bringing this forward. I should call you Dr. Greiling?
Yeah, of course. thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Dominguez, you may want to look on page 17 of the bill. Even though we're only dealing with the Columbia Teen Screen, there's a culturally competent mental health services that I think you might like. So.
It's the question for the Representative Farmers, but I'll really leave it up to you. Is the question for one of the testifiers coming up?
No, not really. It's about the issue.
Oh, please, Representative Farmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make a couple comments. This is the third time I've heard the bill. Since I'm in Mental Health and the Student Disabilities Committee, so there's just a couple points I want to bring up. I know this is a major issue and we need to be addressing it. And I'm all for that. I think everybody will agree on that. One of the things that I mentioned in this other meeting, and I thought I'd bring it up, is that this the questionnaire that the students fill out talks about general health, depression, anxiety, and use of drugs and alcohol. And I know my question the other committee was, I know that this information is private, but this would be good information for the school to have to know if what they're dealing with in a student. Is it up to the parent to bring that information to the school?
Ms. Ayers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I was in that.
Yeah.
This question was put to me one time.
So you're ready for me.
So I am ready because I wasn't quite ready for you last time. The way it would work is the director or whoever it is that's performing the screen and seeing the results would share that with the student, of course, and the student's parent or guardian. And if they chose to share that with a teacher or a faculty member of some sort, that would be their opportunity to do that.
Okay.
The results would not be shared without their consent or without them present. In fact, I don't think they would share it even if they were asked to. I think that the child and or the parent would have to do the sharing if they felt that that was necessary to divulge to somebody.
That's
appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that because I am also concerned about if we are to be aware that a child is on drugs or, you know, has mental illness, we don't want to endanger other students or endanger their lives also. You know, it would be nice to be watching out. So hopefully the parents or the student would bring that forward. Like I said before, I totally agree that we need to be watching out for the mental health issues. I'm just wondering how many schools do you anticipate opting into this, and how many students would be affected by this? That you could ask that first.
Looks like Ms. Aberholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, part of it depends on how much money is appropriated. So if there, we're assuming that, you know, perhaps three projects could be funded. And the Columbia Teen Screen Program itself is free. What isn't free is the support personnel to follow up on what's happening. You have the materials from the Duluth or the Cloquet project, and so it kind of depends if it's a large high school, you know, where they have a 1,000 kids. You figure a percentage of those kids would go through the screening. Most of the programs that I've talked to said that if they could get one kind of mental health professional on contract, you know, that would do it. And I had had. But I don't have it with me. We actually went through some of the high schools looking at, you know, a small, medium, and large high school and figuring out what kind of FTE they would need and the dollar amounts to that. So we're not talking a huge amount of money, though.
Yes, Mr. Chair, but approximately how many students are you hoping to get involved in this?
Ms. Aberholden.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we would certainly hope that a large percentage of families would opt in and say, yes, we would like our student to be screened. So in, I'm trying to think how many high school students there are in Bloomington. I think it's like 2,000 or 3,000, something like that. So if you had, you know, 50% of the students in a school district like that, you know, you'd have 1,500, 200.
Mr. Chair, are we talking certain grade levels, though?
Ms. Aberholt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it would depend on the school district. If they wanted to just do it in a high school, if they wanted to do it in middle and a high school, Teen Screen doesn't go, they suggest you only do it in middle school and high school because of the issues going on at that time.
Mm-hmm. Aren't you glad that I've been able to answer, you know, ask these questions before, so you're ready? I guess I'll end by saying I think this is just one tool, and I really think that we always have to be alert. All the staff in the school has to be alert to be watching for all the signs. And I understand the teacher's licensure renewal that they have to have some training. I think putting some money into that and into even to our pairs and the bus drivers, everybody in the district, to be aware of signs of mental illness and issues for our children would be really good money well spent. And I'm concerned about putting a lot of money into a one-time snapshot in time. Although I'm not against this test, it's just that I could see that the money could be used more efficiently for more people.
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McFarland, what we have found in the several years since we passed the law requiring teachers to get continuing education on mental illness is that school districts will often do a training for all school staff, teachers, paras, you know, everyone, so that they can get a real basic understanding of what mental illness is, the biological nature, things you need to watch out for. There are also programs funded under the suicide prevention grants through the Department of Health, like the Yellow Ribbon Campaign, you know, which also really raises the awareness as well.
Thank you.
Representative Dominguez.
Maybe I can speak to the author on this. On your grant, Section 5, page 17, line 17.34 on the fourth. Okay, what is that COCO late service? What's is that?
Representative Garland. This page 17, members, line 34.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to let Ms. Abderholden answer it as well, but she just told me it's La Familia, that this is the group that they're referring to, yours.
I was Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominguez, NAMI worked with many of the culturally specific providers, including La Familia, to develop this language. And as you know, La Familia has been working in the Minneapolis Public Schools, so it is also about co-locating with the district or with another mental health provider.
Oh, we were just saying it wrong. Now we got the word. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from any members of the committee? We do have other testifiers. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greiling will be instrument for... screening B, the Columbia University Teen Screen Program?
Representative Crowley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garling, I went to the Internet and I, you know, went through each of the questions, and as you can probably imagine, I don't support this, but, you know, I know there are those who suffer from mental illness. There's no question that that's true. But, you know, as I answered each question, I thought, well, my goodness, when I get to the end of this, I think students could almost make themselves think that they suffer from a mental illness based on the vagueness and not only vagueness, but the broadness of the questions. So just this screening instrument scares me. And I've heard from, I don't know if the rest of you have, but I've heard from so many parents who are, you know, deeply concerned about this. And really, from one of my constituents today, who has nothing to do with any organizations that might be sending out these emails, just a very, very sad letter about how her children, who were diagnosed as suffering from mental illness, keep getting re-evaluated and re-evaluated, and it's been so hard on them that this is such a sad story. And she pointed to the school system as that which is messing up everything. So, you know, I hope that if we go forward with any of this, that it is, you know, very, very carefully done, and with the family in the forefront, so that something isn't done, as I read in this email to me from this dear woman about what happened to her family and her children. You know, she thinks they probably suffer from a mental illness, but they have been evaluated so many times. I get the impression that they have gone from school to school, perhaps, And she really faults the public school system for reevaluating them every time they have either entered a new school or maybe a new grade. And that sounds to me like it's very harmful to the progress of the children.
Representative Grayling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, it sounds like there's that your friend, whatever's going on with her children, is something more than taking the Columbia teen screen. If the family doesn't choose to be involved in this, then they aren't. It's an opt-in, unlike this Minnesota Student Survey that's an opt-out. So I don't know that the reevaluating and the reevaluating, especially if she did not wish it, would be the Columbia teen screen. If they have a mental illness, however, and they've been changing schools, you know, that might be another issue if they're in special education. I don't know about the details of that. But I think the story you're recounting is unrelated to the Columbia teen screen. But there are, I did read some figures, Mr. Chair and members and Representative Erickson, about how many students actually take it once it's opted in. Because I asked, you know, once you have to actually take the form home or get it in the mail and, with the families busy and all the things we do or don't do with our mail, how many actually end up being screened? And it's about 67%. There's about 9 or 10% of the families that choose not to participate, and then there's students, furthermore, can choose not to participate, and absences and things like that. So it's certainly not all the kids that, you know, get a chance to take advantage of it, but the 67% that do take advantage of it, there's significant numbers who are helped by it. So I think that's the main goal. And not to, have to be related to the sort of situation that you talked about.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question, Representative Grayling. How closely is this program connected to the pharmaceutical industry? Is there a connection?
Representative Grayling.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, there is no connection. There's a man on there, I think he's their president or somebody on the board, that some people have equated in some internet blogs with a person in a pharmaceutical company, but we actually had him here in Minnesota last year, and some of the members, a lot of new members on this committee, but some of the members of the Mental Health Caucus heard him last year, and he happened to have the same name as a man that's connected with a pharmaceutical company, but he is not the same person. So there is that misinformation out there. They are not funded by pharmaceutical companies. And they make a point of that because there are some who would like to equate them or say that they're trying to drug kids, and so they raise their money elsewhere.
Representative Grayling, we're going to turn to other folks who have signed up to testify on this bill as well. I have two names down right now, Nancy Schumacher and Julie Quist. Ms. Schumacher, perhaps if you'd like to come down first. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay? I've got an awfully soft voice.
We hear you just fine. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Nancy Schumacher. I'm with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. We're an organization that investigates and exposes abuses in the mental health field. Because we are constantly working with people who have been in the mental health field and have suffered a lot of abuses, we find that the methods in which they get into the system are, in many cases, the fault for what continues to happen to them throughout life. We are definitely opposed to the use of the teen screening program as a vehicle for screening for suicide. I'm going to give you some statistics to help you understand where I'm coming from on this issue. It's kind of a graphic representation. This is 45 pages of a symbol, okay? What it represents is 100,000 people, okay? On the first page, there are three different symbols that I've highlighted here. Statistically, in Minnesota, 0.0024% of Minnesota residents under the age of 18 will commit suicide. So just to give you an idea of how big of a situation we're dealing with, these three as opposed to 45 pages of those that do not. I just think it's important that you know that, to have it in perspective when you're dealing with this, that it's not
a massive problem in the state. While losing anyone to suicide is, of course, tragic. I, myself, have had my aunt took her life from suicide. She was in the mental health field getting treatment for many years and did not benefit from it, and, in fact, used the medications that she was taking to kill herself. Okay? I'm sorry. In 2004, for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there were 1.3 million residents of the state of Minnesota 18 years or younger. Of that 1.3 million, 32 committed suicide. Going back to the statistic I gave you earlier, that's a 0.0024% incidence of suicide. Per the Columbia Teen Screen Program, a piece of their literature here. Right here. They gave an example of a screening that they had conducted somewhere in the Midwest. They didn't identify exactly where that screening was done. There was 255 high school students that were screened. 45 of them were sent for referral for further evaluation. Of those 45 that received further evaluation, 24% were prescribed medication. It's a very common tool used in the mental health industry is to use medications as the form of treatment. The medications that are generally prescribed for children, especially those with depression, are known to cause, in some kids, suicidal and homicidal ideations and suicide attempts. It's my concern that in screening large numbers of kids, while you may prevent one or two suicides, you could actually, because of the referral process and the resulting medications, have the negative effect where you're actually creating them. These medications are extremely dangerous. The FDA has put a black box warning on their use for kids 18 and under. They're not mild, they're not innocuous, and they actually have caused many deaths from suicide and homicide, such as happened in the Indian Reservation a few years ago. Someone earlier referred to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and they referred to there being a misinterpretation of it, but I do have the task force document with me, and I will read their summary and recommendation. The USPSTF, that's the name of the task force, found no evidence that screening for suicide risk reduces suicide attempts or mortality. There is limited evidence on the accuracy of screening tools to identify suicide risk in the primary care setting, including tools to identify those at high risk. The task force found insufficient evidence that treatment of those at high risk reduces suicide attempts or mortality. There was another study done. Bear with me. It was done by the Center for the Study of Prevention of Suicide, Department of Psychiatry, University of Rochester Medical Center. It's entitled Screening as an Approach for Adolescent Suicide Prevention. They go through all of the programs and stuff that are currently doing suicide screenings. And one of their recommendations or announcements at the end of the study is, given the lack of an adequate evidence base regarding either the use or the utility of screening programs for preventing suicides, suicide attempts, or factors associated with suicide risk, efforts to use such programs should be regarded as investigational in nature. So I thought it was important for the committee to know that while Teen Screen is touted as being very highly effective in everything, the experts in the area actually consider it investigational.
Okay. Ms. Schumacher, there are a couple of questions from committee members, if we might turn the first. Representative Faust has a question.
I really don't have a question, I have a comment. I'm going to start with a little story, if I can. Pick me up on right there. One time there was a man walking on an ocean, and there had been a terrible storm the night before, and he washed up millions of starfish. He saw these starfish, and he started throwing them back in the ocean one at a time. Mary Baron came by and said, "What are you doing? You can't possibly make a difference with all those starfish." He picked up another starfish and threw it in the ocean. He said, "It makes a difference to that one, though." My son, my oldest son, suffered from mental illness. And he was on medication for about 5 years. And he went through counseling, and he's now doing great. So he is one of your three marks on the first page. So please don't come to me and tell me it's insignificant.
Representative Lockwood.
Thank you very much. I've got some questions on a very serious area that you were talking about, Ms. Schumacher, and that's students who have been on prescription drugs for mental health. Question, who writes the prescription and who legally dispenses of these prescription drugs?
Well, Ms. Schumacher.
It has to be a licensed medical provider, whether that be a general practitioner or a psychiatrist.
So Columbia Teen Screen, they themselves would not be able to prescribe these drugs, is that correct?
No.
Ms. Schumacher.
So,
Representative.
Ultimately, thank you, Mr. Chair, but so if through Columbia Teen Screen, you mentioned the study here where 255 and 45 been identified and 11 were prescribed drugs. And maybe someone else can clarify, these students would then be referred to a doctor? Or how does that work? I mean, certainly they're not given drugs that day when they've been determined.
Exactly, so, not.
They're
referred for further evaluation. Of those referred, 24% end up on a prescription medication.
That's in Markport.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So some doctor then, independent of the Columbia Teen Screen, has had to say that this person should have these prescribed drugs, and as a medical doctor is going to give all the safeguards and precautions and so forth. Would that be correct?
Ms. Schumacher.
I would have to disagree. In many cases, it is just family practitioners and stuff that aren't trained to do those evaluations, but do them anyway. And most doctors do not really understand the side effects of these medications, or most medications for that matter. And it's unlikely that a parent's going to receive all the warnings that they should if they're going to prescribe drugs for their children.
Representative Lockport.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then that's more of a problem with a licensed doctor who could lose their license, I presume, if they're giving out prescription drugs that they know are not going to be helpful or that they, in fact, themselves don't think this person should have the drug. I guess my problem here is you seem to put the problem on Columbia Teen Screen. And in fact, if students are getting prescribed drugs when either they shouldn't or they'll be given these prescribed drugs by licensed doctors who, you know, they may or may not, but if they're prescribing a drug in an area, they should know. But I would think their license might be somewhat questionable. So tell me how that's the fault of the Columbia Teen Screen and not maybe the fault of then a doctor or someone else. I mean, how can you lay the blame on Columbia Teen Screen in this situation?
Ms. Schumacher.
I understand exactly what you're saying, and I'm not laying the blame on Teen Screen. It's the entire system that's been set up. You've got Teen Screen referring, and then the receiver's not having enough data or enough proper information to take it from there. The FDA, as I said, 2 years ago, did issue a black box warning against antidepressants for children under the age of 18. They found that even though there had been recommendations prior to that children specifically be watched very closely when they first get put on these medications, that they weren't being watched. And because of that failure to do the recommendations that were existent prior to the black box warning, they had to issue the black box warning. That warning is one step short of banning a substance altogether.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to belabor this anymore, but I think that's more of a problem than with doctors. And I certainly, doctors make mistakes. I mean, I know that. But I just think that there are enough safeguards in this system. And I think your insinuation was that it was Columbia Teen Screen that basically as you read those stats off, were somehow distributing these prescription drugs. And I think you're completely leaving out licensed doctors who have their reputations at stake in this situation. And hopefully, as medications are being renewed, that they're evaluating the student themselves before they continue to refill a prescription. So I just think that your insinuation here tended to lean on Columbia Teen Screen much more than this whole situation with doctors and so forth. I don't think it was a fair, picture that you painted there.
Okay.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment, having a young man, again, in my home who is taking medication, as a parent, you don't enter into these situations lightly. It's a very, very difficult choice that you make. And the first time that decision was made, we didn't necessarily believe that that was the only option. And so we tried different things first. And so we had many different doctors that gave us many different recommendations in terms of what else we could do first, because many many times parents don't want to medicate their children first. And I think that it is really important to have screening and have someone to go to other than just simply going to the doctor if you believe that they may want to over-medicate. You know, you hear in the news all the time someone saying that someone wants to over-medicate, and so parents, for the most part, are very cautious before doing something drastic like medicating their children.
We do have a second testifier. You want to allow Ms. Quist to also have an opportunity, so I'll invite Ms. Quist to come down and join us as well.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and welcome your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Julie Quist, and I'm with EdWatch. And EdWatch does oppose funding Teen Screen for Minnesota youth, and potentially this begins as early as 9 years old, that they use this screening mechanism. And we are opposed to this because of the lack of consensus within the psychiatric community regarding diagnostic criteria. Also, the very high false positive rates of screening, which we've touched on here, the lack of effectiveness of screening, the overuse of psychiatric drugs in children, and the drug's lack of effectiveness and its dangers. For the record, I'd just like to make the point that Teen Screen is a very controversial issue in the country. We are part of a national outcry of professional and grassroots groups all over the country. I can provide you with a list of many names of groups if you'd like, but the Nevada State School Board, as well as districts all over the country, including San Francisco, Tampa, Florida, and Kenosha, have rejected Teen Screen due to things like this, the consent issues, the high false positives, and the cost. One of the statements that people frequently make is that Teen Screen is accurate. The developer of Teen Screen, Dr. David Schaefer, in his own published journals, acknowledged an astronomical high false positive rate of Teen Screen, and that's 84%. And I do have the reference here from his own material that he published that states as much. He says, in practice, a specificity of 0.83 would deliver many who were not at risk for suicide, and that could reduce the acceptability of a school-based prevention program. Columbia's Teen Screen's positive predictive value of 16% would result in 84 non-suicidal teens being referred for further evaluation for every 16 youths correctly identified. And I think that is a concern, especially among the minority community right now, is that their children are being overdiagnosed and overtreated, over-medicated in the schools, and that is a great concern of them, of theirs. I also wanted to point out, as the earlier individual mentioned, the quote from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force that found no evidence of suicide screening at preventing suicide attempts or lowering suicide rates. The fact is that if cancer screening tests were had false positives of 84% of the patients, it would not be acceptable. Right now, nearly 50% of the children screened in Rochester, New York, were screened positive. And then they were referred to further evaluation. There's a 14-year-old in my own area of Minnesota and that mentioned that most of her friends are on Ritalin or an antipsychotic of some kind. And the problem with the teen screen mechanism is that because it is vague and subjective, because of that vague and subjective criteria, children are being over-referred for treatment and our kids are being over-medicated. The statistics are there to show that the rate of medication of our kids is going up very high, and this will make it go much higher. And finally, my last point is that people will say that it's up to the family and the student to follow up and that nothing is done in the school. But mental health counseling and therapy and referrals happen in the schools. And it's through the school-based clinics and the mental health collaboratives in the schools. And I'm sure that students who test positive on the survey would be referred there. One example that's very well known is Aliyah Gleason, a 13-year-old African-American who was forcibly removed from school and committed to the state mental hospital, denied family contact for 5 months, and drugged with 12 different medications just after school screening. So there are cases like that. Another is Matthew and Shania Dunkel, who died as a result of psychotropic drug toxicity, and I'm sure that you've heard those examples too. The United States House of Representatives passed bills nearly unanimously for two sessions of Congress in a row that were supported by groups as diverse in philosophy as EdWatch and the NAACP, and they were inspired by those kinds of incidents. They were passing laws against being able to any kind of coercion and drugging for that reason. The bills were stalled in the U.S. Senate, and that was due to pressure from the pharmaceutical industry and the education and psychiatry organizations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I know that there's at least one representative, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Quist, I won't debate whether or not children are over-medicated or not, but you did make the quote that they are over-medicated by the schools. You certainly are not suggesting that schools prescribe the drugs.
I don't...
Ms. Quist.
Okay. Mr. Chairman. I said they are being over-medicated. I said that it's the vague and subjective criteria of teen screen. Perhaps I misspoke. I may have. I didn't mean that. That's what I said. But the point I was trying to make is that teen screen's vague and subjective criteria is causing excessive referrals, and treatment is much too frequently medication. The rate of children medication is very, very high, very high.
Representative Lockwood.
And this is the last, but I did write that down, over-medicated by the schools. And I think we have to be very clear, and the reason I make the point is a lot of the statements that get made here are insinuating something that really is not true. It's very simplistic, and people, if they don't delve into it, it sounds over-medicated by the schools. I've heard that before. And we know that's not the case. They might have screening in the school, but it ultimately takes professional doctor with a license who evaluates as their license and reputation at stake that ultimately has to issue that. It's also a parent who, in consultation hopefully with that doctor, decides all of this. So, I mean, I just think the whole picture has to be heard. When I hear things like Columbia Teen Screen basically is prescribing drugs, which isn't word for word, but the insinuation is there without clarification, it gives a very inaccurate picture. And schools take enough guff the way it is. They don't have to be accused of prescribing medication and giving that to students.
Ms. Quist.
The statement I made was that counseling, therapy, and referrals happen in schools. And this is done through the school-based clinics and the mental health collaborative. It is no secret that when you have 84, you know, false positives out of 100, that you're going to have too many kids being told they have a mental illness. That's a lot, and that's very dangerous. For kids to be told at a high rate that they have a mental illness, and the incident in Indiana with Chelsea Rhodes, she's a very normal girl, and she took Teen Screen, and that, by the way, was with passive consent. They say they don't use it anymore, but that was with passive consent, not active consent. And Representative Erickson mentioned, the questions are very vague, very subjective. And they insinuate problems at a high rate. And I think that's very dangerous for children.
Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Quist, I deeply appreciate your passion for your cause here, and I just want you to know that I equally feel a passion for my students. I wish that my student had had an opportunity, and I know his parents wish they had had an opportunity to identify the thing that ultimately caused him to take his life last year. I'm going to have to go back with what Representative Marquardt was saying. When you spoke initially, you stated, and I don't know if you were paraphrasing from your notes, you probably weren't reading verbatim, but you stated in your paraphrase, I believe, that the public schools are providing mental health, that they are doing therapy, that they are doing all of these things. And I want you to know that my school can barely afford our school nurse. I don't know where these therapies are occurring within the school. We have counselors who help kids, but they're not psychiatrists. We have kids coming to them saying, I'm really struggling with some issue or some problem, but these counselors are not psychologists, and they're certainly not psychiatrists. And to echo my colleague, these school counselors cannot prescribe drugs. The school nurse frequently is the primary care physician for a family that cannot afford health care because they don't have health care insurance, adding to her burden. I have a student body of 2,000 kids. We have one school nurse, and she has a part-time aide to address all of the needs in our school that are physical, diabetes, it could be asthma, all the different things that the kids come to school with. So I'm not fond of hyperbole, and I really do hope that when we're discussing these issues, that we leave the hyperbole out and look at what is real, and look at our schools and say, we have to do something. I wish to goodness in my 2,000 student body that I could have been more tuned in to reading the signs. However, I had a class of AP students of 38 kids, and so it was difficult for me to focus on just what those needs were. I'm not trying to lecture you. Please understand that. That is not my intent at all. I just want you to know that I feel passionately about these kids. I love these kids. They are my students. They are a lot more fun, actually, than being here. And so I say this as respectfully as I know how, that we all are concerned for the young people. We may approach it in a different way, but I feel that there is tremendous judgment and negativity in the comments that you made about the public schools. And I want to tell you that we are well trained. We are required by law to have ongoing mental health training each year. We just had a psychiatrist who comes in, and every period is working, doing an in-service with staff all day long so that we get our CEUs for that. So there's a disconnect between your words and what is actually happening, and I appreciate deeply your comments, but I will have to respectfully disagree.
Ms. Quist.
I'd like to make a quick response.
Please.
I appreciate your comments. Thank you. And I would like to just mention that I don't believe 84% false positive is hyperbole. I don't believe that's hyperbole. And I also would point out that there is a great deal of controversy within the psychiatric community regarding the diagnostic criteria. Just want you to know that. So, that is not hyperbole. Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We just heard it again from Ms. Quist, and several times from Ms. Quist, and I think from the previous presenter as well, about it, this 84% false positive rate. And I think I heard from the representatives from NAMI, representative from NAMI, that it was a 19% false positive rate, which was better than the rate for the PAP test. Representative Greiling, or maybe the testifier from NAMI, could you clarify why two people seem so sure of their numbers and yet there's this discrepancy between those numbers?
Representative Morgan, would I hear there's a question for Representative Greiling?
Yes.
Representative Greiling.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, if you were listening carefully to Ms. Abderholden's testimony, because we keep hearing this 84%, but you're right, it's a false positive for the teen screen of 19%, just to compare, a pap smear, the false positive is 24%. With colon cancer, the false positive is 50%. So I don't think we'd skip those tests. As far as the 84% number, Ms. Abderholden covered that in her testimony as well. And I think it would be good, because this is coming up and it's probably going to keep coming up, if we called her back, Mr. Chair, just to refute that bit of misinformation.
On this point,
on
yes, please. On the 84% of the Representative Morgan's question, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Now we get to test my, go back to my knowledge of statistics. In your packet, I did pull out the information. What happened in the when you look at the rate of false positives is what they didn't look at is that the research paper looked at the students who fell into the very high risk group of teenagers, defined as those who were both thinking about suicide or who had attempted suicide and who also had a major depressive or substance abuse disorder. So the research paper only focused on the number of high risk teens. It didn't explore all of them. So it's, you know, it's kind of a, you know, we used to always, you know, make a play on word about statistics in terms of how you play with them and how you pull them out. So it wasn't looking at the entire body of students.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you. So check my math if it's correct. So what you're saying is that 16% of those students screened were in that highest risk of suicide, I guess, of committing suicide area, but another 65% of those screened were at some risk of some other mental illness, mental health issue that then they could go, if their parents chose, and they chose to receive treatment for those mental health issues, and that only 19% of those students identified really were at no risk at all.
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I understand you're a math teacher, and it's late at night for me after a couple of late nights. but yes, that sounds about right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
I do want to make sure that there's anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill. Seeing none, any other questions by any other member of the committee? If none, the motion. We are going to hold over this bill, lay it over. Oh, no, sorry, we're referring. I apologize. This bill will be, you would like to move this bill to be passed, Representative Garland?
Okay. Mr. Chair, this would be also for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
I think we are. The original motion was to pass and we refer to the Education Finance Division.
Mr. Chair, you're right. I forgot we've got, at one time this was a lot of little bills, yes. And I just had the Columbia Teen Screen bill. The lateness of the hour, I forgot this is now a big bill and it does need to go on to housing, I believe. If you got that.
I will read you. The motion is to pass the bill. We refer to the Education Finance Division with further recommendation for referral to the Housing Policy and Finance and Public Health Finance Division. Are there any questions? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. And the meeting is adjourned.